Hey folks, it's Stuart and Adam here. As you'll hear, we recorded this episode on WrestleMania Sunday, which was obviously a couple of days before the sad passing of the Ultimate Warrior. So I thought we'd just add some quick thoughts here before we get into the episode. Adam, you spoke very early on about memories of the Ultimate Warrior. Anything you want to share now?
Yeah, like when I first started watching as a kid, I think he was by far and away my favourite superstar of the time because he just had a look and an intensity. And as a kid, I kind of saw past his, you know, his obvious failings in the ring. As such, he wasn't the most crisp performer as such, but he had a charisma that sort of really spoke out on television. And yeah, he was just amazing.
I think I got into it a little too late to be there when Warrior was at his peak, but one of my very early memories is his feud with Papa Shango, which may have led to my ultimate love of Papa Shango, but that's beside the point.
Well, we all love Papa Shango.
Obviously, he's someone we'll cover at a later date in the podcast as he turns up in 1996. He was a man who had a lot of sort of controversial politics and opinions, which I imagine we'll cover at a later date. Obviously, he gets mentioned in this episode about the steroid trial and stuff. I think, obviously, his death is kind of very much tied in with all the steroid stuff. It's another guy who's aged 54 and died of a massive heart attack. Ultimately, it's very nice that they managed to bury the hatchet with the WWE and his Hall of Fame speech. And it's nice that he got a chance to do that, which Savage never got.
Yeah, and we're not left with that lasting memory of the self-destruction of the Ultimate Warrior, which is really, well,
a burial.
Yeah, completely. It's about an hour and a half of people just saying how rubbish he was.
So it is nice for him that he got to get his side of the story across.
Yeah, and the promo that he cuts on Raw the night before he dies.
Very poignant now.
Yeah, really, really good.
Quite eerie. Well, I just wanted to get some quick thoughts in. Hope you guys enjoy the episode. Thank you.
First on one, it's Eyes Down for Book. Full House.
Book. Funk. Parker and Meng. Book. Funk. Parker and Meng.
Ladies and gentlemen, the master of the house.
Bunkhouse. Monkhouse.
I gotta say, Paul, I didn't see this one coming.
Hello, and welcome to episode 9 of the New Generation Project podcast, where we honour the heroes of Hulkamania and analyse the architects of attitude in looking at the dark ages of the WWF, the mid-90s. My name's Stuart Brooks. I'm joined today by my very own Money Incorporated. It's the Million Dollar Man, Paul Scrivens.
Hell yeah.
And Adam R. Scheister, ARS.
Pay your taxes.
Did you not like the acronym, ARS?
Be better with an E at the end.
Arse. Yeah. I got it. Yeah.
It's Luna's butt. You get it?
Oh, yeah. Now see? I get it even more.
That's a joke I worked a long time on.
Well, successful.
How are you both doing?
I'm mildly hungover.
And I'm on a sugar high.
So this should be an interesting episode. Professional that we are here.
And how are you?
Yes, very well. Excited for WrestleMania, I must say.
We must point out we are recording on WrestleMania morning.
So we're going to avoid making predictions today in case they're wildly wrong and we sound really silly.
We'll splice them in later.
Yeah, sounds good. We'll record them tomorrow. Today's episode is SummerSlam 1994, but we've got a lot of stuff to get through before we get there. I thought I'd ask you a quick question. So in light of a match on this pay-per-view, what are your favourite matches where wrestlers have wrestled themselves?
I don't know. Have there been many others?
Did Diesel ever wrestle fake Diesel?
Probably Diesel faced Isaac Yankum, maybe, I don't know.
Well, did fake Kane ever wrestle Kane? Or was he
Yes, there was Kane versus the fake Kane, wasn't there?
Did they actually ever face off?
Yeah, I'm sure they had a match on Raw, yeah.
Sin Cara against Sin Cara swings to mind.
Good stuff. No, the actual question is, favourite cage matches?
Right, okay. One very random one springs to mind, but I do have in mind Val Venus against Rikishi.
Oh, yeah.
Fully Loaded 2000, maybe?
Definitely a Fully Loaded. I can't remember which one, but it was the Rikishi's move off the top of the cage, which was very unexpected.
For a big guy, yeah. That's got to hurt.
Outstanding.
Adam?
I'm really struggling to remember any cage matches.
How hungover are you?
Well, that's quite telling, isn't it? I remember the Venus Rikishi one, and I've seen Superfly jump off the cage. I don't know, none of them really stand out massively in my mind.
Well, bravo.
Yeah. Sorry.
What about you, Stuart?
There's a AJ Styles Abyss cage match in TNA that I recall being rather very good.
Ah, yes. Was that with the Styles clashing to thumbtacks?
Yes, and it's the one where he dives out of the cage to start the match as well.
Yes.
Which I thought was quite cool. And there's a Samoa Joe Jay Briscoe cage match, which is very good, from early Ring of Honor.
Okay.
Very, very violent, very, very bloody. I'm sure you'd love it, Paul, actually.
Oh, did I see one? Oh, what's that chap's name?
Who are you trying to remember?
Jimmy Jacobs. He had a cage match.
Yeah, there's a Jimmy Jacobs BJ Whitmer cage match.
Yes.
That's very good
as well. I remember you showing me that a few years ago.
As far as WWF ones, the Rock Triple H one from Rebellion 99 is very, very good, especially considering it's on an English pay-per-view. So, it's been a long time coming, but the biggest wrestling event of 1994 is here. The steroid trial of Vince McMahon. We begin on July the 5th in Uniondale, New York. McMahon was indicted in late 1993 by the US Justice Department on 2 counts of steroid distribution and 1 count of conspiracy to distribute steroids, and was staring down the barrel of 11 years in prison and facing $1.5 million in fines.
Did he go to prison?
Well, that's what I'm going to go through, dickhead. I might just leave that in.
Yeah.
It was considered that the government would have a tougher time proving conspiracy charges against McMahon than possession. The government accused McMahon of 2 offences. Number 1, possessing with intent to distribute steroids to a WWF performer, believed to be Hulk Hogan, for non-medicinal purposes on 2 specific occasions. And 2, trying to cover up and thus defraud the government's attempts to regulate illegal use of steroids by WWF performers so the wrestlers could continue to take steroids and be bigger and thus sell more tickets and make him more money. The defence argued for all 3 counts to be dropped. The judge dropped the 2 possession with intent to distribute counts, 2 and 3, based on lack of valid jurisdiction in the Eastern District. Vince's defence had been confident that there was no way the conspiracy count could hold up because there was never a meeting of the minds between Vince McMahon and Dr. George Zahorian. The defence tried to argue that the steroids were legal for wrestlers to take during the time in question, and that even if steroids were unhealthy, it was better that they got pharmaceutical-grade steroids from Dr. Zahorian rather than black market steroids, which could be dangerous. The judge, however, was preoccupied with the lack of a true doctor-patient relationship between Dr. Zahorian and the WWF wrestlers. Zahorian testified that the WWF never made money from his steroid sales and did not share in the profits. He said 98 to 99% of his customers were WWF wrestlers. He said he gave wrestlers whatever they wanted, but rarely were WWF officials watching when he did so. He did state that state athletic commissioners were sometimes in the area when he distributed. He said he was not acting properly as a physician and he didn't do follow-up examinations. He said that giving steroids to wrestlers was against my ethics and I was wrong. He said it was improper to let patients decide what they wanted. He said the cash and carry method was wrong. He said sending steroids via FedEx was wrong, and he admitted that he let his customers decide what drugs he gave them.
Sounds like a stand-up guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Admitted it all, at least.
Has
he found God at this point? Turned face, done a Shawn Michaels?
It's all just a bit odd to listen to all of this.
In what way?
Well, it's just that I haven't had time. It's a lot of information to digest.
Yeah.
It really is.
This is 60 pages worth of digestion.
Yeah.
It's a bit shady and underhand, and it's quite interesting that it's all been going on and they've still been managing to keep the company all functioning.
But the thing is, it's look at the guys. It's obvious that it has been going on.
From the physiques of the performance.
Everybody can see that there is obviously, it's being taken somehow.
But obviously the crux of the trial is, has Vince told people to take steroids?
Yes.
That's what this is based upon. And has he been conspiring with this Dr. Zahorian for his performers to take them? That's the crux of it.
Yeah.
Did you say Zahorian's put on for forcing steroids on anyone? Or just...
No, he's not put for forcing, yeah.
People went up to him and said, give me some steroids, and he just said, yeah, all right then.
All right, yeah, what do you want?
But he wasn't going around and saying, hey, take steroids.
No.
That was what Vince was up for.
That's allegedly what Vince has done. Yeah.
Okay.
Testimony was heard from Randy Colley, a.k.a. Moondog Rex, who said that he was removed from the Demolition tag team, not because he wouldn't take steroids, but because fans chanted Moondog at him. Tom Zenk, who said he began using steroids in 1981, long before he joined the WWF, and that it was his own personal choice to take them. Terry Zubzinski, aka The Warlord, who said that Bret Hart was known for putting drawings on blackboards in locker rooms, and that he often drew a wrestler leaning over with needles sticking out of his ass.
Was The Warlord on steroids?
He also said he weighed 195 pounds before taking steroids and now weighs 305.
Fucking hell.
Tully Blanchard, who also said that he took steroids before going to the WWF, and that in a meeting with McMahon regarding his signing, McMahon said cocaine was not acceptable, but steroids and other stuff was okay.
But is that him, you know, telling him to take steroids, or...
Well, that's the argument, yeah. Isn't it? Rick Rude said that there was a period where he and his wife were trying for a family, so he was off steroids. He said that McMahon commented to him at a TV taping that I didn't look good. He said McMahon was happy with his wrestling and interviews, but not his look. I told him I was trying to establish a family, so I was not on anything. He told me to push myself. I understood that to mean I wasn't taking anything, but that I should be. Kevin Kelly, aka Nails, said that he was told by McMahon to be as big as he could be. However, his testimony was somewhat negated by the fact that he had a pending personal lawsuit against Vince McMahon. He was also asked two questions by McMahon attorney Laura Brevetti. Isn't it a fact that you have personal animosity against Vince McMahon? Nails said no. Brevetti asked, do you hate Vince McMahon? Nails said, yes.
clever bloke, Nails.
No axe to grind there. It's now time for our main event, witnesses. Up first is Jim Helwig, a.k.a. the Ultimate Warrior.
He was never on steroids.
Definitely not. Warrior talked about an incident in February 1991 at a Marriott hotel where he got in trouble for leaving steroids in his hotel room. He also, and I love this, said that McMahon never told him to take steroids, but also never told him not to take steroids. That's how the law works, definitely.
Bit grey.
I've never told Adam to take steroids, but I've also never told Adam not to take steroids.
That is true.
Paul Scrivens' court trial begins July 7th. The last wrestler to testify, obviously, was Terry Bollea, a.k.a. Hulk Hogan. He admitted that upon his return to the WWF in 1983, steroids were commonly seen and that he had used them. He admitted to placing orders for steroids from Zahorian indirectly through McMahon's assistant and another witness, Emily Feinberg. Hogan said that during his time with the company, it was very common for wrestlers to be taking steroids and that he had a prescription for them. Hogan admitted to having placed orders through others for steroids from Zahorian, but only for personal use. Hogan went even as far to say that McMahon never ordered or directed him to take steroids. By this point, despite his defection to WCW and strained relationship with McMahon, Hogan had perhaps become the defense's best witness. He stated that he paid for steroids with his own money, that McMahon assistant Feinberg collected Hogan's steroids for him under his orders, not McMahon's. Hogan said that he and McMahon were as close as brothers and that he respected McMahon. Hogan admitted to teaching McMahon himself how to use steroids in the summer of 1988. He admitted to lying in his 1991 appearance on the Arsenio Hall show, where he claimed he'd never used steroids.
Yeah, I've seen that.
I think I have as well.
So, at 4 p.m. on July the 22nd, 1994, after 16 hours of deliberation, Vince McMahon was found not guilty in the eyes of the 12 jurors in the case. Vince escaped having to serve any time in jail at all, though one of the distribution charges was pending a retrial later in the year. Vince told the press afterwards that he was delighted with the outcome and was looking forward to getting back to doing what he does best, promoting steroid-infused monsters. No, sorry, I mean promoting pro wrestling.
That was certainly a good result for Vince.
It's worked out all right for him,
really. Do you know what the ratio was from the 12?
In nothing I read, it said what the swing was. Thoughts on that stuff, then?
I think Vince is a very lucky man.
It's a huge event. It, you know, in terms of the history of the sport, or the sports entertainment, it's a massive decision, isn't it?
Well, I mean, if you take a sort of alternate universe theory where Vince goes to jail, yes, the entire landscape of wrestling is massively different.
Because I wonder how Jerry Jarrett would have handled things.
Or Bill Watts or whoever, is in place to take over, yeah.
So, I mean, it's quite interesting to hear about all that background. But it's something that even as... Because I'm kind of what you'd call more of a casual wrestling fan, kind of dipping in and out as and when I have time to watch and get into stuff. I've not heard much of the background to any of that. I mean, I've heard of Zahorian before, but didn't know much. So, yeah, fascinating insight. Thank you, Stuart.
You're welcome. In a pretty sad development since our last WWF episode, longtime WWF referee Joey Morella died on July the 4th, 1994, when he fell asleep at the wheel and crashed after refereeing at a WWF event in Ocean City, Maryland. Morella was the son of Gorilla Monsoon, and according to an interview with Sean Waltman conducted by Kayfabe Commentaries, Monsoon was never the same again after his son's death. He also stated that the house show loop they were doing at the time was particularly grueling, and that had the schedule been easier, Morella's death could have been been prevented. No reference to his death was ever made on WWF television.
Oh.
Well, that's really tragic.
Yeah. How long had he been with them for?
10 years.
And no mention?
Not mentioned at all.
Harsh.
Yeah. Well, it's just, I guess, it's the bit of wrestling that you don't see. It's, you know, perhaps if you watch something like The Road Diaries, Cabana and Bryan,
yeah,
you kind of get a bit of the insight into the travel side of things and how grueling things are. And if you read a few of the biographies and autobiographies, you get to know about the heavy schedule. But
yeah, it's the toll it takes on people.
You know, when you're watching WrestleMania or you're watching the Royal Rumble, you don't really take into account the route there,
yeah,
these guys.
Mm. And, yeah, it's not Learjets and limos.
Yeah, and also the other guys, you know, the people, the production team, the people putting up the ring.
Yeah.
You know, they've all got to travel there.
In actual wrestling-related news, 2 days prior to this show, on August the 27th, 1994, at the ECW Arena in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, the NWA had decided to use an Eastern Championship Wrestling show to stage their tournament to crown a new NWA World Heavyweight Champion. This didn't work out so well for them. The winner of the tournament was Shane Douglas, who, after defeating Too Cold Scorpio in the tourney finals, threw the title belt down, saying that he did not accept it and instead was proclaiming himself the first Extreme Championship Wrestling World Heavyweight Champion. ECW was born.
Another big wrestling development.
Yes.
It's really kind of big time, isn't it?
Yeah, there's a lot going on. Hogan's just signed for WCW. Vince is a free man. ECW's about to really take off. It's Monday, August the 29th, 1994.
Monday.
And we are live from the United Center in Chicago, Illinois, in front of a crowd of 23,000, although only 19,500 actually paid to get in.
It's been papered.
It's been papered.
Another one of those.
The show drew a live gate of $386,000, pretty damn good for the time, and a pay-per-view buy rate of 1.25 for a gross of 3.56 million. In the dark match for this show, newly babyface Adam Bomb defeated Quang.
We didn't get to see an Adam Bomb Quang match.
You didn't get to see the Adam Bomb Quang feud.
Oh,
there's a whole feud.
There's a whole feud.
Was it good?
No.
Oh.
Ray Rougeau here. The Undertaker mystery is thickening. I want to start that over. I didn't like it.
There I was, heading poolside, trying to catch some rain. Sorry, Ray. The girls were feeling macho.
Macho, man. You're so big.
Easy now, girls. It's family entertainment. Yeah.
I had work to do. I was scanning around the globe for clues to the biggest mystery of our time. The sun was extremely bright.
If your deductive capabilities were a fraction of what you profess, this incognito caper would have been solved by now.
Thank you, son. Right kid. And he was right. After all this time, I'm still tormented by that one burning question. How can there be two Undertakers? Maybe one is corrupt like you. Police, arrest that man. I will solve this case at SummerSlam.
Pre-show. Did we watch the pre-show?
No.
We did.
Was Johnny Polo on it?
No.
Oh, I want to know what people had for their breakfast again.
Gutted.
So Pettingill's mullet has kind of grown.
What was happening with that? I mean, I didn't see the pre-show, but later on in the event, he was just bizarre.
Well, he's a knob, isn't he? But
there's a bit in the pre-show, which again, could have changed the course of wrestling history, where he's sitting over the ledge of a balcony, hanging over the arena. And if someone had just sort of gone up behind him and just done a quick nudge, job done. There's also a bit where he stands near a balcony. And yeah, someone could have pushed him off then as well.
What actually happened on the pre-show?
We got to see the best advert ever for the new generation with the impersonators doing the...
Yes, it was almost like Scrivens.
Was doing like Razor Ramon and Macho Man impersonations.
This is the one that I talked about like about four episodes ago.
Yeah, but now we've actually seen it.
Where the woman's sitting on the bench.
Yes.
And you,
yes,
were saying, oh, you were saying that his impressions were worse than yours.
They are.
And I don't think they are.
They
I think
are.
They're slightly better than
they
yours.
Are. No.
Senorita, say hello to the bad guy.
Hey, baby, I'm execution excellence.
Oh, yeah, dig it. Oh, yeah, dig it. Oh, yeah, digging it.
Mr. Savage.
You can call me Rayleigh.
Don't fall for cheap imitations.
Give us a Razor Ramon impression.
What's he say?
Hey, Chico. Something like that.
There's something about oozing machismo.
Ooh.
Yeah, that's the worst Razor Ramon impression I've ever heard in my life.
I need somebody to do it so I can copy them. I just can't think what it's like. Ooh.
That's definitely not it. There's a bit in the pre-show as well where The Undertaker delivers Leslie Nielsen Domino's pizza.
I love that. Yeah. In fact, I really like Leslie Nielsen.
I did wonder if there was some kind of deal with Domino's, because a couple of times, just out of nowhere, Vince McMahon says, and Domino's delivers.
Does he?
Yeah,
I thought the commentary on this show was really, really quiet, actually.
It was, yeah. The crowd noise was either too loud or the commentary was too quiet. I couldn't work out which. But the mix of it was slightly off.
I didn't notice.
To open, we see highlights of a charity softball game between WWF superstars and the Chicago media.
Yeah.
Shawn Michaels is still a knob, even when charity's involved.
Yeah. And Macho Man's really good.
Yeah, being a former baseball player, I suppose that makes sense.
Is he?
Yeah.
I did not know that. That explains why he's really good then.
He home runs it out of the park.
Out of the park.
If that's what they say in baseball. We were going to ask you a question, actually, Paul. If you had to put together a wrestling T20 team, who do you think you'd put on it?
All right. I'd probably want X-Pac in there, or the 1-2-3 kid.
Yeah, he did a good catch in the softball game, actually.
I can imagine. Just he's very athletic.
Mabel.
No.
Wicket keeper,
yeah. Actually, wicket keeper.
Nothing getting past him.
No, true that.
I can't see him diving for catches, though.
I don't think he'd need to.
No, I could imagine people like Shawn Michaels being annoyingly good. Probably Brett would be all right.
Who'd be your big, big, hard-hitting batsman, though? Your Chris Gayle?
Who's my Chris Gayle? My Chris Gayle would be Bam Bam Bigelow.
Yeah.
Bam Bam Bigelow. He would hit the ball at a good distance.
You reckon? Yeah.
I do reckon.
That's fair enough.
He wasn't in the softball game, was he?
No. Not that I saw, anyway.
The arena looks huge as this show opens.
Yes.
It's a new arena.
Yes, they do interview the new owner later on, doesn't they? And he looks like he's got no idea what's going on. It's Art Donovan levels of awareness.
He looks kind of scared. You know, the way that really old people look kind of scared when they don't know what's happening.
I can't believe I booked this for my brand new arena.
I didn't know what it was.
The first wrestler we see on this card is the Macho Man. He enters to pomp and circumstance in a very nice suit.
Lovely. The matching man does look good.
He cuts a promo putting over the new generation and the event and introduces the hosts, Jailbirds Vince McMahon and Jerry Lawler.
The Jailbirds, that could be a new tag team.
That's their tag team gimmick, yeah. Vince looks somewhat and sounds somewhat relieved, I thought.
Well, you would be. I imagine he spent a good year looking and sounding relieved.
Lawler tells us about a tag title change and they discuss the various matches on the card. Lawler tells us the British Bulldog is here and brings up SummerSlam 1992.
That's the London Wembley
Arena.
That's
the Wembley Arena one.
And British Bulldog looks massive.
Our first match is the Head Shrinkers versus IRS and Bam Bam Bigelow. So, what happened to the Head Shrinkers tag team titles?
They lost them.
Well, they lost them. The night before SummerSlam in Indianapolis, Indiana, they dropped the straps to Shawn Michaels and Diesel. So I guess Shawn's decided he's fancies wrestling again for a bit.
Yeah.
I want a belt. Give me one.
As for their opponents, well, welcome to the beginnings of one of the worst factions of all time, the Million Dollar Corporation. Following his not-so-successful appearance as a colour commentator at the Royal Rumble, Ted DiBiase turned his hand to management. Following WrestleMania 10, DiBiase began first appearing on Raw, simply sitting in the crowd. Later, he bought...
That's a really good gig. I know. I'll come back and I'll just sit and watch.
Yeah. Later, he bought three fans front row seats. Also spotted in the crowds on episodes of Raw was Hulkamania antique Nikolai Volkov, who on the 25th of April episode of Raw appeared on the King's Court to say that he had fallen on hard times but would not beg for work as he was a proud man. Apparently times were not so hard that he couldn't afford front row tickets to wrestling events. On the 16th of May episode of King's Court, DiBiase appeared alongside Volkov, basically saying he had bought the former WWF Tag Team Champion. The Million Dollar Man's next acquisition was the Beast from the East, whose contract he had purchased from Luna Vachon. DiBiase debuted as Bam Bam Bigelow's manager on the 2nd of July episode of All American Wrestling.
So is this the end of the Bam Bam Luna relationship?
Yeah, they're done now. No more squeezes, no longer. No. IRS debuted as part of the stable on the 8th of August episode of Raw, teaming with Bigelow against Tatanka and Doink the Clown. IRS's inclusion in the stable is somewhat logical given their past run as Money Incorporated. Hmm. This match was due to be for the tag team titles until the Head Shrinkers lost them the previous evening.
Careless.
I love DiBiase's music. I think it's one of their best ever theme tunes.
Yeah, it's good.
It's a shame this group's so terrible.
They had the funky lighting back again for this.
The million dollar signs.
Well, the $3 signs, but I guess it's trying to represent more money than that.
The $3 man isn't such a good gimmick.
Really poor guy.
Like three-man band.
He's wearing like his jogging bottoms in this though, isn't he? The Million Dollar Man.
Yeah.
He's got his shiny like top on, but it's like he's forgot the trousers, so he's just nipped out to buy some jogging bottoms.
He's the Million Dollar Tracksuit Man. IRS and Bam Bam get decent boos on their entrance, and the Head Shrinkers have some new headgear.
I'd put them a bit like feathered Pope hats.
Crowns. You mean a mitre?
Was that the name for it?
Yeah, I think they're called a mitre. M-I-T-R-E. Okay.
I thought they looked like, what are those things like pilgrims wear? The American pilgrims, or that they put on turkeys or something. I thought it looked like that.
A turkey hat.
A turkey hat, yeah.
Are we all of the opinion that these hats were not a good look for the head shrink?
No, it wasn't a good addition to their wardrobe.
Well,
no.
they must have been large headwear of some description, because Jerry King Lawler says that they've got big heads but puny brains.
Maybe that's why they're so hard to headbutt them.
Maybe it is.
Yeah,
got really thick skulls.
Bam Bam and Fatu start with some shoulder blocks from Bam Bam before Fatu takes over. An attempted slam into a pin by Fatu ends up with a pin for Bam Bam. A Gamangiri from Bam Bam.
A Gamangiri?
That's the kick he does that's a bit like an Enziguri, but a bit different.
Ah, because I just put it down. Bam. He must have a foot like a traction engine.
Bam Bam misses the top rope headbutt. We get a nice clothesline from Fatu before Samu comes in and they double super kick him.
And this is a point where they talk about Domino's delivers. Just Vince says it. I mean, it was as random as that comment just then.
Was pizza delivery like a new thing in America in 1994?
I was wondering if it was, because, yeah, it's this whole thing about delivers is what
that's
they
keep the
saying.
Key part of their strategy now.
It is, yeah.
Prior to this, just have shops where you had to like go in, buy a pizza and then walk off.
They're still saying in this that Bam Bam Bigelow is weighing 400 pounds. Vince is definitely still saying that.
And on the back of the Bam Bam Bigelow figure Adam bought me for my birthday, it says he weighs 325 pounds.
Yeah.
Well, maybe this was that weight gain that we had at
King of the Ring. Bam Bam tags IRS and IRS ducks a Samu crossbody before diving to the outside himself.
He did this before, didn't he? The last match we saw him in. It's a nice bump. I quite like it.
It was a big bump.
Fatu whacks him into the steel steps on the outside as well. What? An IRS match where there's a pace?
And no chin lock.
It was a rapid match.
Fatu is back in for some double teaming before Bam Bam lowers the rope, so Fatu falls to the outside, where Bam Bam gets his kicks in. Revenge for the steel steps, I suppose. Bam Bam gets back in, and a double crossbody takes Bam Bam and Fatu down. I love big men doing that spot. We like the one where Bam Bam and Tatonka did it at the Rumble, but when two big fat guys collide in midair.
it had good oomph.
Both teams make tags, and Samu hits both opponents with back body drops. He hits a headbutt from the second rope that IRS just doesn't react to. You know, the way where someone sort of dives at you and people would sort of flop to show they've been hit, IRS just does nothing. Just lays there. They toss Bam Bam to the outside, and the head shrinkers hit a clumsy double face crusher type thing.
Was it like an SCF kind of move, but a double SCF?
What's an SCF?
Isn't that school crushing finale?
Oh, Miz's thing. Yeah.
But it did look awkward and not very well executed.
It did. I think it was perhaps a timing thing.
But then they go up to a top rope splash, don't they?
Yes, Fatu does have a nice
and
splash.
That is amazing.
Rope. DiBiase distracts the ref while Bam Bam breaks up the pin and whacks Lou Albano. Afa gets in for no real reason, and the ref spots this for the DQ.
I didn't really see that coming. It's over.
No, it was a very random conclusion to the match. But then we get a nice little beat down.
Yeah, the head shrinkers take out Bam Bam after the bell, and the two teams sort of brawl to the back as refs escort them away.
I mean, they're putting some triple headbutts, don't they, at some point? Yeah.
And also a particularly sick kick by Rikishi.
I thought it was too short to be anything great, really, but bar the face crusher thing, it wasn't terrible and it moved along at a nice pace.
I liked it. The crowd were into it as well.
And IRS was barely in there, so I'm happy with that.
And what he was doing was generally a lot better than what we've seen him do before.
It was definitely the best match we've had with IRS in it.
And he didn't have a microphone, and he didn't tell anyone that they hadn't paid their taxes.
I suppose now there's actual music playing when he enters. Yeah. He can't cut that one promo.
Yeah, which is a benefit, really, because we've all heard it.
Because I'm fucking sick of it.
Yeah. Or maybe he's checked out everybody's tax status and they've all paid.
Yeah, maybe everyone in Chicago's all right, though.
In which case I would want him to come out and cut the opposite promo where he's like, you've all paid your taxes. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
That would be great.
He could come out handing out receipts to people, maybe.
It was some different people in an opener as well.
Yeah.
It was good. It's a decent opener.
Yeah. Backstage, Leslie Nielsen is hot on the Undertaker's trail.
Oh, my God.
I think they've misunderstood punning, don't you?
See, this was terrible, I thought. Absolutely terrible.
I quite liked it.
Speaks volumes, Adam.
It's because I really like the Naked Gun films and Police Squad, and it was very much like that. And if you've not really seen that, I guess it doesn't make an awful lot of sense.
I've seen one of the Naked Gun films, and like I do like it, but it was so out of place.
I just think, like I say, they just misunderstand how it works, though. There's the promo at the start of the pre-show where they're trying to do innuendo, and there's a bit where Nielsen says the girls were feeling macho, which is a sentence just doesn't make sense. And then it cuts to obviously some girls touching Macho Man. And then he says the sun was very bright, and there's like a young boy with glasses saying something smart out of a newspaper. That's not a sentence that makes sense. The sun was bright. You wouldn't say the sun was bright. You would say my sun was bright, which then isn't a pun or an innuendo. They've misunderstood how it works. And Leslie Nielsen has just gone along with it. He is good at his character, but but...
Well, in this case, it turned out that they were both on the case, both standing on the case. Do you get that?
Yes, yes, they're on the case. They're also on the trail, and in the background is a sign that says Undertaker Trail. Yeah. I see what they've done there.
With a double-headed arrow.
We get a backstage promo for Coliseum Home Video from Razor Ramon. Did you get this on your version of it?
No,
Paul?
I didn't. No.
I gave Paul the WWE Network version of it, and we watched the Tag Classics version, so there may be slight differences in what we've seen. What did you make to this Razor promo, Adam?
I liked it. I like his promos.
He's pretty good at his character still.
Yeah, spot on.
And you wonder why I can't do a Razor impression where you give me a version of it with no Razor promos in.
Anyway, he tells us he'll have Walter Payton at his side.
To which I thought, who's Walter Payton?
Yes.
NFL Hall of Famer.
There we go.
There you go.
Was he good?
I don't know. I know nothing about American football.
Okay.
Our next match is Alundra Blaze versus Bull Nakano.
This was interesting.
Bull Nakano debuted as a professional wrestler in All Japan Women's Pro Wrestling, AJW, in 1983, aged just 15.
15? Is that 15. Legal to wrestle when you're 15 years old?
Yes, it is in Japan. She held numerous singles and tag team titles in Japan before making her way to Mexico in 1992. She debuted in the WWF on a card in Yokohama, Japan on May the 7th, 1994, and she made her TV debut on the 1st of August 1994 edition of Raw, the storyline being that Luna Vachon had used the cash she got from selling Bam Bam Bigelow's contract to Ted DiBiase to bring in Bull Nakano to take the women's title from Alundra Blaze. Nakano and Blaze fought to a double countout, setting up this title match.
The first thing I've got to say is, Adam, what do you make of Bull Nakano's hair?
Surprisingly enough, I liked it.
I'm shocked.
I'm going to put it down as a mullet, but I think it's a product constructed mullet.
Define that for me, please.
So, well, I can't say for sure, but I don't think the hair has been cut into a mullet shape. I think she's just crafted it with some kind of glue so that the front part is more stable and upright instead of falling forwards.
It's about the front of her hair is about a foot long vertical climb.
It's spectacular construction, actually. And it didn't lose a lot of its rigidity throughout the match.
No,
I don't know what she's using.
Something about Mary hair gel.
Well, possibly. But no, it was spectacular.
She gets the WWF's generic Oriental music to bring her out as well, which they previously used for the Orient Express.
We need to know that she's not from America.
What did you make of her look overall? Because it's quite different from, I imagine, any women's wrestler you've seen.
I thought it was brilliant. I really liked it. I quite liked she had the kind of blue kind of lines
on her
face. The
veins going down her face,
Yeah, it's really cool. The hair is cool, kind of like just a bit mysterious but badass kind of look.
Adam?
Yeah, she's kind of the female equivalent of the monster character, I would guess.
Yeah, absolutely. Next out is Alundra Blaze, and she's got herself a cape.
Yeah, she's as super girl.
As any good superhero should, yes.
Works fair enough. But did she have a cape before?
I don't think so.
I don't think she did, no.
She drops it at the entrance, though, doesn't she? Yeah.
I don't think she drops it. Well, she did, but she deliberately. It wasn't like she was careless. Well,
she removed it rather than dropped it.
Yes.
Yeah.
I felt you implied she was just careless with it.
Oh, no. It was intended, but she dropped it.
Some small children give them both flowers, which is nice.
The one that gave the flowers to Alundra Blaze looked petrified. It was kind of like somebody's daughter that kind of said, oh, you work for the company, here's a chance to be on TV, but she really didn't want to be there.
Luna tosses the flowers that were given to Bull at Blaze and runs away in that pantomime villain way.
I quite like Luna. She's got rid of all the shit on her face, hasn't she? Her face is kind of clean now.
Now, I wasn't sure about this because at some point, Jerry the King Lawler says, somebody's got like a face like a stopped clock or a face that could stop a clock. And then he says, she has a face that could stop Switzerland.
Well, I presume they make a lot of clocks.
Lost clocks. Yeah. Which I got, I didn't, it wasn't clear who he was talking about.
It was probably Alundra Blaze.
Yeah, because he talks about Bull being attractive in
yes,
the
match. Yes, he does, yeah.
Is it odd to see this version of Jerry Lawler that's dissing the supposedly attractive female babyface?
Yes, it is.
And I didn't really note down anything that he put, but he's pretty merciless again in his mockery of her as he goes through.
He doesn't quite call her a horse, but I guess he says she could stop Switzerland.
Yeah.
It's harsh. Pretty bad.
And they do class as much as Beauty and the Beast.
We start off fast with Nakano avoiding a Blaze dropkick before throwing Blaze across the ring by her hair twice.
There's lots of hair-based offense in the first couple of minutes of the match. That's Bull's move are centered around the hair, leading me to think that that's her source of power.
So what he's saying is, Alundra Blaze should have bought him Brutus the Barber Beefcake.
Or chopped off that hair.
As a manager.
They could have done this, kind of like a hair versus hair match.
They don't do that with women that much. There's the one at WrestleMania 20, isn't there?
Molly
with
Holly,
Molly Holly and Victoria, yeah, where they shave her head.
That, I've got to say, that's quite gutsy
for a female performer to do. Yeah, but those throws across the ring by the hair look vicious.
They do, and I'd say there's lots of hair kind of grabbing, kind of pulling up by the hair. It'd be painful.
The crowd pops for it as well, which is nice to see.
The crowd are mad into this match.
And all the moves that Bull Nakano does are very stiff. And they look really painful. She's like, she could have joined up with the Road Warriors. It's that type of...
She looks like she could hold her own in a man's match.
A clothesline and a leg drop as well, I thought, were pretty stiff. Yeah.
I noted that she's been watching Bruce Hart. for the clothesline.
She's been training in the dungeon with Bruce.
And also, they do note that she is a consummate athlete. This is about Blaze, Alundra Blaze. But then they do say that Bull Nakano has the weight advantage and the wrestling ability advantage.
Bull rests with a chin lock while the crowd pulls for Blaze. We get a USA chant, kind of. That just sounds like a few guys in the front row chanting USA, but it does pick up.
Yeah.
Bull does a cocky pin, another great SmackDown one move.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Chris Jericho staple.
Bull whips Blaze to the ropes for a powerbomb, but Alundra hits a Hurricanrana and a spin kick.
Excellent.
Unless you want to call it a Frankensteiner. Bull avoids another spin kick with a choke into a slam before holding on a Boston Crab.
That was
with
cool.
With one arm.
The one arm Boston Crab looked really cool.
It looked badass.
Mm-hmm. Blaze eventually gets to the ropes. Bull pulls her back into the ring and applies the Scorpion Crosslock.
I've got to say, without doubt, this is the coolest looking submission move that I have seen.
It's pretty damn awesome.
Yeah.
I don't recall ever seeing it before.
Paige used it recently in a NXT Arrival match with Emma. It was the finisher of the match as well, which was pretty damn cool.
I was very surprised that this wasn't the end of the match.
Visually, it looks really cool as well.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because physically, there's no way you can get to the ropes in that kind of submission either.
No.
You're not going anywhere because your arms and your legs are both sort of tied up.
Did any blokes use it?
I think you've got to be quite bendy to have it applied to you.
And you couldn't do it on someone that's too big or heavy, could you?
No.
You'd do that on Viscera.
I mean, you could perhaps have like a really big guy doing it on perhaps somebody like X-Pac.
Yeah.
But, you know, as soon as you're too big, it's just not going to work.
But we agree, this is an awesome move.
It is an awesome move.
Yeah. Luna interferes before we get a school girl. By Blaze?
I guess that's what it is called.
Is that right?
Yeah, I think so.
No.
Yeah.
Does it sound any worse than schoolboy?
Well, it depends how you phrase it.
We get Alberto Del Rio's cross arm breaker by Bull.
That was good. Yeah. Very good. And again, she looks like she's, with all her moves, it looks very real. She looks like she's putting on pressure. It's not just, I'm going to kind of move into this hold and do anything like that. It is, I'm doing this, and it looks like it bloody hurts.
Luna on the outside screams, break it off. And what's she screaming about? That was my Art Donovan impression.
It was good.
Oh.
Who's that girl?
Who's that girl? What's she screaming about?
Okay. How much does this guy weigh?
Is she a wrestler?
Is she a wrestler?
Is this girl one of the wrestlers?
Blaze takes over, pulling Bull to the mat by her hair. So, yeah, there's your hair-based offense, Bull.
Yeah, it is.
Turnabout is fair play, I guess.
I mean, there's a few, I don't know quite what it's called, if this is what you're describing, because it happened about 3 or 4 times, where she's like dragging her down by hair.
Yeah.
And the bumps are huge, though. It looks like it could do damage to your neck. Again, this match is convincing on a level that you don't often see.
Blaze sets Bull up for a powerbomb, but that ain't happening. We get a back body drop by Bull. A pin by Bull Nakano, which Alundra Blaze, and I've described this as, matrix is out of.
I put slips out.
It's kind of like a limbo move, isn't it?
Yeah. But it was cool. It was different. Interesting.
Yeah.
Fresh.
But she does, however, for her efforts, run into a lariat by Bull Nakano.
And my God, was that a lariat.
It's a cool sequence as
well. Yeah, very good sequence. Yeah.
Bull charges into the corner, but Blaze jumps over her for a pin. She runs into Bull and gets powerbombed.
Yeah.
Another big spot there. Bull Nakano goes to the top rope for her finisher, which is a top rope leg drop, but misses. Blaze kicks Luna off the apron and then German suplexes Bull for the 3 count.
It was a lovely German suplex as well.
It was crisp. It was perfect. Textbook.
And the crowd throughout this match were absolutely red hot. It's very different. I've not seen many matches like this. It is the best women's match I've ever seen. It was an outstanding match.
My note here is to just ask you to compare this to sort of women's matches today. Would this hold up? Would this be better?
Yes.
Yeah, miles better.
This
blanket decision there.
The Bella Twins versus, who else is in the women's division?
Oksana and Alicia Fox.
Yeah, you might get a broken eye socket maybe if Oksana's in it, which is pretty cool.
But I mean, if you just said to anyone tonight, you know, if they're watching WrestleMania and this match was on there, you'd be more than happy to see this. It doesn't matter, or this quality of match, if it was men's match, women's match, tag team match, I don't care what it is. If you see that quality of wrestling, you're going away happy. I would much rather watch this match than a whole lot of other stuff that's going to go on tonight.
Fair enough.
This was fantastic. Yeah. Absolutely brilliant. Yeah.
Stunning.
It is, like, in terms of women's wrestling, best match I've ever seen.
Fair enough. Nakano would eventually take the women's title from Blaze on the 20th of November 1994 at the AJW show Big Egg Wrestling Universe.
Big Egg Wrestling Universe, that sounds something special.
A mammoth card that featured 23 matches and lasted 10 hours.
10 hours?
I've got to say, I wouldn't want to be in that crowd.
Mere weeks later, at the beginning of December, Nakano would be suspended for cocaine possession. She would later drop the title back to Blaze on the April the 3rd, 1995 edition of Raw, kicking off another women's angle, but we'll discuss that nearer the time. So, sadly, Paul, this is the only appearance on pay-per-view of Bull Nakano. So.
At this stage, it's probably worth pointing out that we've had, you know, over a year's worth of pay-per-view matches. We've seen two women's matches, and they have both been of high quality, but we've only had two of them.
Good point.
Well, that's all you're getting.
Yeah, at this point, I'm thinking the women's division's where it's at.
Yeah.
Nakano retired from professional wrestling in 1997, but appeared sporadically until 2001. Can you guess her next career?
Commentator.
Ballroom dancer.
Professional ladies golfer, of course.
What? I bet she could thrash the ball.
Maybe you could have her in my cricket team.
In 2012, she promoted her own retirement ceremony in Tokyo Dome Hall, entitled Empress. The show was divided into two parts. The first section was matches featuring both current and veteran Joshi wrestlers, and the second was the retirement ceremony, where clips of her classic matches were shown, alongside live recreations of particular moments. Wanting the audience to still see her as Bull Nakano, she gained 88 pounds solely for the purpose of looking like her classic in-ring character. Now that is method acting.
Yeah, that's cool. Nero, isn't it?
Yeah. She now runs a bar in Tokyo. Did you know, Adam, that we saw her perform live?
Oh, I was not aware of that.
Yes, the late 1994 Heart Attack tour, which Adam and I both attended in our long gone youth.
Yeah, even though we didn't know each
other. Before we knew each other. Yes, I went with a friend. I think you went with your brother.
Yeah.
One of the matches there was Alundra Blaze versus Bull Nakano.
And yes, again, I wasn't invited.
I've sketchy memories of it, but I don't remember the women's.
The matches I remember from that show, you had Brett and Bulldog against Owen and Neidhart.
I remember Yokozuna, Undertaker.
IRS and the 1-2-3 Kid, for some reason, has decided to lodge itself in my memory. And Luger was there as well, and I'm positive Jeff Jarrett was there as well.
I don't remember them.
I'll have to look up the card, but yeah, Alundra Blaze and Bull Nakano were on it.
I wish I'd have paid more attention.
If only you'd have known 20 years later, you'd really like one of her matches.
Weird.
Thank you very much, Vince. We are indeed here with the new WWF Tag Team Champions. Just last night, Market Square Arena, Indianapolis, Big Daddy Cool, Intercontinental Champion Diesel, and Shawn Michaels, Heartbreak Kid, taking the titles away from the Head Shrinkers.
That's right, Tosh. You know something? Between Big Daddy Cool and myself, collectively, we have held the Intercontinental Championship belt for the last 2 years. So we got to thinking the Heartbreak Hotel needs just a little bit more gold. So we decided to go out and become the World Wrestling Federation Tag Team Champions. And what happens? Presto, change-o, Big Daddy Cool and the Heartbreak Kid deliver. Just proven that we are the two most happening cats in all of the World Wrestling Federation.
However, tonight it will not be a tag title match.
Duh, Pinhead.
It'll be the bad guy, Razor Ramon, against Diesel one-on-one.
The self-proclaimed bad guy, Razor Ramon. Well, maybe my moniker should be Midas, because everything I touch turns to gold. Well, let me tell you something, bad guy. In the Windy City, tonight, it ain't gonna happen. You ain't getting my gold. You know why? Because me and the Heartbreak like where we're at, and that's on top. Bad guy, you've had a lot of chances, and you haven't come through yet. What makes you think it's gonna happen tonight?
Folks, we may be...
It ain't gonna happen.
We may be overlooking one thing. NFL Hall of Famer, Sweetness, former Chicago Bear, Walter Payton.
I got news for you. Big Daddy Cool and the Heartbreak Kid overlook everybody, especially you, you little munchkin. I got news for you, Razor Ramon and Sweetness. When Diesel and the Heartbreak Kid get done with you, you two cats are going to be oh so bitter. Oh, let's go, big man.
It's promo time with Shawn and Diesel. Shawn is gurning again.
Right.
Shawn is excellent again.
We need to take some time out to discuss what Shawn's wearing, I think.
Go for it.
Well, my best description is he looks like a cross between a zebra and a train driver. Do you want to have a go, Adam?
I think it's the gayest outfit that's ever been devised. And I know that we seem to say that a lot about Shawn Michaels' outfits, but he keeps upping the ante. It's like he's gone and said, I'll tell you what, I want some chaps, some kind of cod piece, and I'd like a jacket with bits cut out of it covered in mirrors, and I'd like a silly hat, and I'd like it all in zebra print, and then I'd like two massive earrings that reach my nipples. What do you reckon? And someone said, yeah, Sean, spot on, spot on.
That's just what I had in mind.
It is unreal. Yeah. I look forward to watching more Shawn Michaels matches where he tries to outdo himself again.
I think he should dress like that now.
Just dresses like a cowboy now, doesn't he? I wonder if he's still got all these outfits. I wonder if he's got a massive wardrobe that's just full of all his old outfits.
You'll have to ask him. I thought Diesel was a pretty good promo here.
Yeah.
Yes, yeah, his best yet, I think.
Adam, he did some shouting.
Liked it. Yeah. I don't remember what he was saying, but I do remember him shouting it and looking like he meant it.
And you were scared and convinced.
This was a big, scary guy, yeah.
I wasn't. I don't think it was 100% yet. I think it's about 80, 85%. He was kind of shouting, but it doesn't look like he truly believes it. Right here, I'm pointing at the chest.
He's not on warrior levels yet, but I don't think that he's been backstage having a massive briefcase full of drugs before he went out. So,
okay.
Although Sean probably has.
He calls Walter Payton a munchkin. Our next match is Razor Ramon versus Diesel for the Intercontinental title. This match was announced on the 23rd of July episode of WWF Superstars. On the 6th of August episode, it was announced that NFL Hall of Famer Walter Payton would be in Razor's corner to counteract the antics of Diesel's manager, Michaels. There's nothing much more to say here in terms of build or storyline, apart from the fact that Michaels and Razor had another excellent match on the 1st of August edition of Raw. The champion is out first to big heat.
Why did he come out first?
I guess because Peyton's in Razor's corner and they're in Chicago and he's a big deal. I mean, he's not CM Punk, but he seems to be a pretty big deal in Chicago.
It's one thing that we noticed, that the crowd care about this guy.
This is
one time where they've got a celebrity in there that works. He adds something to the match because the crowd are well aware of who he is.
He's no Art Donovan.
Yes, they've upped themselves from Art Donovan. They didn't put him on commentary all night.
Just remembered what Diesel says in his promo, actually.
Go on, then.
He talks about having the Midas touch because everything he has turns to gold.
Oh, he has got two bits of gold.
Yeah.
Sean comes out behind Diesel, but then does a little dance to come out in front of him.
I love that. Diesel's coming out, but I'm Shawn Michaels, so I'm going to get right in front of him.
Probably me next.
Such a twatish thing to do.
Their tag team pose is pretty cool as well.
With the fists
in the air. I like that.
Yeah.
Razor gets a big pop when his music hits, which gets bigger when he and Walter enter.
Well, when he came out, I was thinking one thing. Are they going to be like Adam's pants that he designed and put on Facebook?
No.
Shall I talk about the pants?
You may as well. Let's get it out of the way.
The time to talk about the pants.
At Ramon pants, obviously.
At Ramon pants.
Yeah, they're better than my design. I think he's outdone himself. I think these are probably the best ones that he's had. I couldn't tell because obviously we were watching it in standard definition, but it kind of looked like...
I thought they were turquoisey.
I thought it was maybe it was kind of a purpley type thing, but it had like a shiny Jackson Pollock effort all over it.
I've put a little nasty boys.
A little bit nasty boys, yes. A little bit nasty boys. And a little bit Bret Hart with
his jizz thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Only more shiny. Yeah. I really liked it.
I like the outfit as a whole. Yeah, looked pretty cool.
Yeah, very nice.
Razor tosses his toothpick at Diesel and we are on. Diesel bumps for Razor's fists pretty well. I'll give him credit for that.
Yeah, fair enough.
And goes to the outside. Big Daddy Cool strategizes with the Heartbreak Kid.
I thought that this made him look a bit weak because I think if you're Diesel, you're a bit of a big monster and you should just be chomping at the bit to get in there and just to murder this guy. And just having to have a little pep talk saying, you know, I'll go and get him. Just is a bit pathetic.
I liked the way he bumped for those fists, though.
I like the way he bumped. Really good. He's certainly improved his selling.
Diesel takes over with elbows and clubs to the back and a clothesline. Razor ducks a big boot and clotheslines Diesel before Diesel cuts him off again. We get a big boot in the corner from Diesel, which, according to Jim Cornette, I think is move number 4 of Kevin Nash's. Diesel slows things down with a sleeper before Razor gets a side suplex.
That was a nice little sequence.
And the crowd are really into it.
The crowd are all over this, but I was annoyed by some kids that keep waving at the ceiling because they're kind of on the hard camera and they're obviously kind of looking at the screens up top. They were very off-putting for me. Just thought I'd drop that in.
I didn't pick up on them.
But you were obviously watching the match instead.
Yeah, I wasn't scoping for kids in the audience.
You are a bad person.
Well, apparently you are.
No, you know what? I was trying to at some point look for any decent signs in the crowd, but I didn't really see any decent signs in the crowd this pay-per-view.
While we're on that point, I don't think the sign production's been very good, actually. Since we saw our beautiful Undertaker or Yokozuna in a casket sign, yeah. I think...
Or Yoko Tuna.
Yeah, Yoko Tuna.
We've not really seen any great signs.
Well, maybe that could be your next Photoshop project, Adam. Some mid-90s wrestling signs.
What would have been good to take along? Yeah, I can do that.
What the crowd should have done.
Diesel sends Razor to the outside, which again is a big bump for a big guy to be taken. Sean takes off the turnbuckle cover, the CAD, then taunts Walter Payton. When the ref restrains Payton, Sean launches a forearm off the steps to take down Razor. Again, that looks pretty cool.
Yeah.
But Sean is kind of making this match all about him.
Yeah.
Shocking.
He's not the most selfless performer, is he?
No. And again, he probably takes the biggest bump in the match later on.
Yeah. I want to say, I had an award suggested to me on Facebook of changing the MVP of the night to the Bruce Hart Award.
Yeah, I saw that.
But I have decided to create the Bruce Hart Award, and it's called the Bruce Hart Award for Best Attempt at Getting Over at Somebody Else's Expense.
Okay.
And on this pay-per-view, that goes to Shawn Michaels.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, Bruce gives it a good go himself.
Bruce gives it a good go himself later.
But no one can outdo Shawn on that type of thing.
I suppose, though, all these antics that Shawn Michaels is doing does actually work around Diesel's limitations. This is another 20-minute match that we're seeing out of Diesel. Mm. And
it's good.
Yeah, and it's good. And he hasn't got 20 minutes worth of stuff to be doing, so Shawn's antics fill up a good bulk of that time as well and make it interesting.
I thought the three guys worked nicely together here. I mean, obviously...
Walter Payton,
yeah, I haven't written his name down. Did they not call him Sweetness?
I think that's...
Is that his nickname? Yeah.
Which is a good wrestling nickname, actually.
It is, yeah. Sweetness.
Sweetness Paul Scruggs.
Yeah.
It's good.
Well, I said I was on a sugar high.
That'd be a gimmick. You're always eating sugar.
I'm wandering down to the ring with my big bag of Haribo.
No, just a big bag of sugar.
Earl Hebner, valiant babyface, covers the turnbuckle that Sean exposed.
That I really liked.
Distracted by Sean, so Diesel sends Razor into it. We get a side slam for a 2 by Diesel.
That was cool. Gets good height on those.
Yeah. Diesel hits Snake Eyes, but not onto the exposed turnbuckle. Peyton's interference, unlike Sean's, keeps backfiring. So whenever he tries to do something, Earl Hebner is right on it, but Sean manages to get away with everything.
It's because Shawn Michaels is so inconspicuous.
Yeah. We get a chin lock by Diesel.
Well, he's taking his jacket off at this point, hasn't he? It's, you know.
He practically blends into the crowd.
We get a chin lock by Diesel to slow the pace down, so the match itself isn't going along at a million miles an hour, but the corner men make this whole thing work. Razor powers out to a big reaction. We get a big boot by Diesel, but Razor gets his foot on the ropes. An abdominal stretch by Diesel, plus extra leverage, obviously.
Yeah.
Razor gets his own abdominal stretch, but Diesel hip tosses him out of it.
That I thought was really nice. For Diesel to do kind of quite a quick counter like that was nice.
A Snake Eyes attempt again, but Diesel goes gut first into the exposed turnbuckle, and then Razor hits a schoolboy for a 2. Razor whips Diesel into the corner, but Diesel moves and Razor slides out of the ring, grabs Diesel's legs and crotches him on the ring post.
I really like
good
that
little segment.
It was very smoothly done, because that can sometimes look a bit awkward when they slide out and it can be a bit sloppy,
especially with big guys doing it as
well. Can be.
We quickly get back into the ring for a big bulldog for a 2, which Diesel takes head first.
It was a big it was, you know, bulldog off the top rope pretty much, wasn't it?
Sean gets on the apron and for the second pay-per-view on a row takes the biggest bump, launching himself into the guardrail courtesy of a Razor fist.
Part of me thinks, oh my god, and part of me just loves it, and I can't really work out which side of the fence I'm
it's
landing
the right
on this
one
time. Well, it's the fact that over the top and ridiculous, but it's kind of entertaining.
Yeah,
I really don't know where I stand on that. I kind of guess I like the entertainment. So
Adam,
well, isn't that really, you could apply that sentence to wrestling as a whole. It's over the top and ridiculous, but it's entertaining.
There's kind of different levels of over the top now, isn't
so
there?
So is Shawn Michaels just like the mega wrestler?
Because you
he's
kind of have
some sort of line.
You have kind of the kind of the natural exuberance and the over the topness. Terrible expression of
over the topness.
English me good.
of me fail English. That's impossible.
But you kind of get that level of, you know, hokiness. And then you take it up a notch, and for me, it doesn't work. But then you can take it to that next level where it's kind of bad becomes good again. Okay. Do you know what I mean?
So by you're kind of getting out of just like the stage of theatrics.
Yes.
And you start to become something too pantomime-like.
Yes.
However, if you take it over further, that pantomime line to something really ridiculous, it's then okay.
Yeah.
And Shawn Michaels over that line.
He's so far over the line, he can't even see the damn line.
I think you need to draw us a graph, Paul. with this.
I could draw your graph.
Yeah. At what point is Shawn Michaels over the line?
Anyway, we'll come snorted the line.
We'll come up with an equation for the line.
Razor sets Diesel up on the top rope, but Diesel elbows out. Would love to have seen what they tried there. Diesel calls for the jackknife, but Razor gets a back body drop. Razor signals for the edge to a big pop, and Shawn is back up on the apron. We get a big shoulder block by Diesel before Shawn grabs the Intercontinental title and has a little bit of a tug of war with Walter Payton.
Which he loses. Mm.
Hebner obviously goes to admonish Walter Payton rather than Shawn Michaels. So Shawn enters.
He still can't see him.
No. And as Diesel holds Razor for a super kick, Ramon ducks and HBK nails Big Daddy Cool.
On the slow-mo that it shows later, he does actually connect with Razor as well. Oh, okay. All the way through. It almost like it's a bit of a stuttery kick. He has to give Razor a little bit more time to get fully out of the way, and it doesn't get particularly high.
Okay.
It's a rather underwhelming super kick, I thought.
Yeah. It's not really in Diesel's face, is it? It's chest area.
It's kind of diaphragm height.
Shawn dances for a bit and then gets chased by Walter Payton. Ramon crawls over and Hebner counts the three. Big pop. Diesel is unhappy with Shawn after the bell as Ramon celebrates.
They wander to the back.
They wander to the
back. Both looking slightly dejected.
This match had a lot of bells and whistles, and the match was more about Shawn Diesel than Razor Diesel, but it was entertaining, and it worked within what Diesel was capable of. Yeah,
it was good
stuff.
It was good, yeah.
Decent. I wouldn't say it was good or outstanding. Decent, solid.
Yeah.
I was happy with it. Without
the other two outside players, then it could have been a crap match, isn't it? Because it would have just been a bit too slow, given the same amount of time. But once you add those elements into it, it actually becomes quite entertaining.
How do we feel about the Intercontinental title being back on Razor Ramon?
Good.
I think he's a good person to carry the title.
I've got to say, because I'm not Diesel's biggest fan, and obviously I missed the end of the King of the Ring match with Diesel and Brett,
yeah,
due to the DVD player not working. And so I didn't see what sounded like was a good portion of that match. But I think his performance here has definitely improved. I think he's going in the right direction. And I'm kind of starting to look forward to seeing more of Diesel now, which I wasn't before.
Yeah, he's okay. Good.
But I do hate his music. It's
not music. It's just a noise. And has it made you feel any better towards Razor Ramon's music? Because he's actually got music.
No.
Oh. I'm still loving Razor Ramon's music.
I wish I'd watched this match on mute.
Randy Savage offers his opinions, congratulating Razor Ramon. Coliseum video shows us Diesel, who isn't happy. He hates his tag belt and is pissed at Shawn, so he throws it on the floor, then picks it back up again.
Yeah. I didn't get
goes,
to see
at least I've still got this.
That was quite funny, because he says it's a pittance or something, doesn't he? Chucks it on the floor, shouts a bit, and then just bends down and picks it up and walks off with it.
We then cut to Shawn, who is anxious about what Diesel might think, but that may just be the drugs.
Yeah, he's jonesing.
Folks, right now I'm standing between Made in the USA Lex Luger and the Native American superstar Tatanka. Gentlemen, before we do anything, we've got to give you the results of the WWF SummerSlam Hotline Opinion Poll. Thank you. The burning question, did Lex sell out to the $1 Million Man, Ted DiBiase? Here are the results. 54% of you said yes, he sold out. 46% of you said no. Lex, your reaction to those numbers?
You know, Todd, you can take all the opinion polls you'd ever want to take.
I'm so tired of hearing you that you didn't sell out. At least 54% of the people in this great country has got the right opinion. You know, Lex, the whole world is going to find out that you sold out. You know that you sold out. More important, I know that you sold out. I've got plenty of facts and plenty of proof. How about the time on King's Court when the $1 Million Man said it's a done deal? It's a done deal, Lex. How about when the $1 Million Man came down by ringside and he was watching you, Lex? How about on Heartbreak Hotel when you're saying you didn't sell out? I'm telling you, telling the whole world the truth that you sold out. You and Ted on a first name basis. Ted, Lex, Lex, Ted. Come on, Lex, you sold out. How about when I come down after my match, where'd I find you? In the $1 Million Man's dressing room. Oh, how about this one? $1 Million Man comes down and conveniently helps you defeat Crush. And more important than that, everyone's seen it today. Everyone's seen it. The $1 Million Man coming to your dressing room with a red, white, and blue bag. What does the bag got? Plenty of money, Lex? You sold out. The whole world is going to find out in a few moments that you sold out. I said I can beat you anywhere, any place. Well, today is the time. I'm going to ringside. You go get the $1 Million Man and come strut down ringside, because I'll be waiting for you in the ring.
You know, they could show all the footage they want of Ted DiBiase saying and doing whatever he pleases. It's a free country. He can say Tatanka whatever he thinks he believes in. It's a free country. But deep down in my soul, I know what the truth is. I didn't sell out. I never considered selling out.
And that's what we're going to find out tonight. Because I'm going out the ring by myself, like I always do. And I'm going to win this match by myself, like I always do, without anybody's help, like Ted DiBiase's.
Todd Pettingill is with Lex Luger and Tatanka. He chairs an all-time classic promo.
This is a three-shot.
Yep.
There's three people in it. There's three people I don't want to see.
We get a hotline opinion poll.
I was glad to see the appearance of the hotline opinion poll.
It's because it's percentages?
Not just because it was percentages, but mainly because it was dissing on Luger.
Yeah.
Really.
54% of people think Luger has sold out to the Million Dollar Man. Luger starts to talk, but Tatanka cuts him off. Tatanka offers a lot of circumstantial evidence of Luger selling out, and then Lex gets to cut a bit of a promo when Tatanka's music hits.
I think I've just got written down here, Tatanka cuts his shit promo, because it was rubbish.
Yeah.
There was no energy, no emotion in it. It was just...
No. I mean, I think the other thing for me in this promo is it doesn't talk about the sample size. You know, it just says 54%, but...
54% of what?
Yeah, you know.
One person.
Well, it's not going to be one person. That obviously wouldn't make mathematical sense. But, you know, was it of 50 people? You know, was it of 500,000 people? You know, those sorts of things. You know, when you're watching the old, you know, say, shampoo commercials and they say kind of, you know, 9 out of 10 women agree that Pantene gives you the shiniest hair. It usually has a kind of, you know, 297 people survey, that kind of thing. That's what I'd want to see on this. More Pantene adverts.
Anyway. It's the rematch of the century. Fuck Hogan versus Flair. It's the match that captivated us all so relentlessly in episode 1. It's Tatanka Luger 2.
I've waited so long to see this.
But hang on a second, there's actually a storyline here going into this match. On the 11th of July episode of Raw, Ted DiBiase told Jerry Lawler that he had bought Lex Luger. It's a good job he's not buying any black competitors, isn't it? It's okay when he's buying white people.
Oh, okay, yeah. Like, otherwise, it might be a bit...
racist.
Yeah, a bit slavey.
Mm. Yeah, well, they had that deal with Virgil, but yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
We'll see if he adds any black athletes to the Million Dollar Corporation.
There's not really many black athletes hanging about at this point, is there? Oh, no, there's Men on a Mission.
Yeah, maybe he could buy Mabel.
Or Mo. I don't know where Mo is.
Do you care?
No.
On the following week's Raw, Luger faced Intercontinental Champion Diesel with a question hanging over him, had he sold out to the Million Dollar Man? The match went to a double DQ when both Shawn Michaels and Razor Ramon interfered. After the bout, DiBiase was seen in the aisleway, angry that Lex hadn't won the belt. Just chokes on everything, doesn't he? On the 23rd of July episode of WWF Superstars, DiBiase appeared as a guest on Shawn Michaels' Heartbreak Hotel, introducing Lex Luger. Taking some time, Luger did eventually appear, but before he could either confirm or deny whether he had sold out, Tatanka appeared and said that he knew that Lex had sold out. DiBiase said that the Native American was jealous of Luger and that Luger could beat Tatanka any time. Luger then claimed that he had not, in fact, sold out. On the 25th of July episode of Raw, Tatanka faced off against Corporation member Nikolai Volkov in a $10,000 challenge match. The challenge being that if Tatanka won, DiBiase would give Tatanka that amount of his own money. Tatanka won and Randy Savage urged the Million Dollar Man to pay up. Reluctantly, DiBiase did, but told Tatanka he wouldn't be able to defeat his man, Luger, so easily. Tatanka disagreed, leading to Luger's appearance where the two men agreed to face off. It was then announced that the bout would take place at SummerSlam. What followed would be weeks of tension between Luger and Tatanka with DiBiase in the background, with segments where Luger's actions could be misconstrued. For example, Luger in the Million Dollar Man's locker room screaming at Nikolai Volkov means to Tatanka that Lex has sold out to DiBiase. I actually have pretty fond memories of this storyline. It is something I quite vividly recall from being a child, believe it or not.
Sounds lame.
It may very, very well be. Having just summed it up, though, do you not think it's a step more towards the weekly episodic stuff we see on Raw these days?
I guess. Yeah,
that's just true.
Tatanka enters and gets booed. Lex enters and gets booed.
Yeah, no one's winning here.
Yeah.
What's Lex Luger's status here? Is he face or heel or what? I didn't get it.
Well, that's the storyline,
yeah,
Paul.
Yeah, we don't know.
You're invested in the storyline. Do you not understand?
No, I'm not invested in it.
54% of the people think that he is heel.
54% of you thinks he is a face and 46% thinks he's a heel.
Well, no, because I don't care enough about Lex Luger. I don't care enough about Lex Luger. Either way, it just kind of, it made me even more ambivalent, if I'm honest.
Look, his main event runs over. Just be happy that he's in the mid card. So I guess in some ways this story is a success.
I'm not happy that he's on the card.
Okay. Tatanka does look meaner than he used to, so I wonder if that's foreshadowing anything.
Mm, I can't see what's coming.
His hair's changed.
Yeah, he's got rid of the red bit.
Mm. And he's kind of regrown his mullet.
Are you happy with that, Adam?
No. Okay. I think I've gone into it before. I don't like Tatanka's mullet.
I didn't think it was particularly mulletish. I thought it was shorter and just looked wet.
It's getting there. It's definitely been swimming. It's definitely greasier. He's kind of got his greasy mullet on. And I'll make the point that I've been thinking about who Lex Luger looks like. And we had a shot of him. I thought he looked very, very much like MacGyver. I don't know whether that's just in my head.
Vince notes that there is no $1 million man anywhere near the squared circle. Tatanka is really, really, really angry about Lex selling out.
He's still shouting. Yeah. I mean,
My note here is, methinks the lady doth protest too much. The ref has to separate the two of them to start. And we do get you sold out chance. So that 54% of the crowd is rather vocal. They lock up a couple of times to start, but nobody has the advantage. Luger gets a headlock and Tatanka pushes him into the ropes. But Lex takes the Native American down with a shoulder block. They then reverse armringers for a bit. So it's kind of odd to see wrestling with Lex Luger and Tatanka.
You know what I noticed in this match?
Go on then.
That the pants are just as catching.
Yeah, it's Tatanka doing it.
Tatanka's
well.
Caught. It. Okay. They're both doing it. They're both at it. I reckon 54% of this match is pants adjusts.
Excellent.
And the other 46% isn't.
Tatanka hits a crossbody for a two before Luger hits a crap small package for a two.
Really crap.
I guess he's trying to wrestle like a baby face, like small packages like a baby face move. I guess he's trying. I don't know.
If you do it badly, though.
They resort to fisticuffs before a big hip toss by Lex. There's a low hum of kind of boos in this match. It felt very much like a Batista segment.
Yeah. No one was really sure what they're supposed to feel, so a bit of low booing is probably the safest option.
Yeah. Lex's elbow drop looks like he's trying to lay down on the mat. He doesn't fall correctly for an elbow drop. It looks weird. Vince sells the atmosphere by saying the crowd doesn't know what to make of this situation. It'll need that line again later tonight. Tatanka dances to boos and then chops. Suplex by Tatanka before a top rope chop for a two. Lex avoids a top rope something to boos.
Yeah.
Lex hits a couple of clotheslines that don't appear to make contact to boos. Ted DiBiase appears with a bag. Taboos. He has a wad of cash in his hand and distracts Lex, letting Tatanka get a schoolboy for the three. Taboos. Tatanka is pleased, but Lex is pissed. The $1 million man enters the ring as the ref gets between Lex and Tatanka. Lex turns to face the $1 million man and kicks the bag of money out of his hand before Tatanka attacks. Taboos. It was a setup all along. It was a swerve.
It was me all along.
It was him all along, Austin. It was Tatanka all along. That's who should have been the higher power. Tatanka beats Lex down. Tatanka and DiBiase hug Taboos.
I did have hashtag heel hugs.
They go to leave, but the $1 million man suggests Luger deserves more, so Tatanka gives him a bit more of a kick in. He applies the $1 million dream. Great submission.
Yeah.
As Luger has a nap, Tatanka shoves money in his mouth. You know what? This wasn't good by any stretch of the imagination, but the atmosphere was interesting, and hey, it wasn't 15 minutes.
Oh, I didn't like it.
You didn't like it?
No.
Why not?
I didn't think it was very good.
It wasn't very good.
It really didn't catch my interest at all. And I thought that the finish was so obvious. They needed to do a kick out there.
Did you see the heel turn coming?
I didn't.
Or you just didn't care enough?
No, I really didn't care enough about this match.
I saw it coming.
Yeah.
What did you make to it, Adam?
I don't really like either of the competitors as competitors. That affects like what I think of the match. So yeah, there's a swerve and there's a turn and there's a double cross, but it's with people that I don't really give a crap about.
Okay.
So I think reasonable development and orchestration of a storyline, but not really for me.
I think the thing that's good about it, having watched it at the time, is that obviously Luger had been a heel before, so there was reason to believe he could be a cunt again, whereas Tatanka had just been a pure babyface ever since he'd come in. So really, you had no reason to disbelieve Tatanka. He'd always been a good guy, whereas Lex had been a bad guy before. So there was that part of it that I did like. I'm not saying it was good by any stretch of the imagination, but it's an angle for people in the mid card, which is a rarity today. Today they'd all just be shoved in a battle royal. Oh, today they all are shoved in a battle royal.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
One thing that a couple of bits that I did like in the match.
Go on then.
The referee's got a bizarre mullet going on, which I quite liked, and there was a lovely shot at the end. You know when when Tatanka's turned and he's beating up Lex Luger, you get this shot of like a, I don't know what sort of denomination it is, like a $50 bill or something, by the ring post, which is in focus. And you can, in the background, you see just out of focus is Tatanka kicking the shit out of Lex Luger. I quite like that as a shot. It was nicely composed.
He's all about the money.
He is.
Our next match is another five-star classic. It's Jeff Jarrett versus Mabel. There's no feud here, therefore no reason this match should be happening. Jarrett and Mabel had a brief confrontation on Raw the week before SummerSlam, almost as if the WWF remembered this match was on the card and they should probably remind the audience and do something to promote it. The angle they chose was rap versus country, which I guess, depending on your musical taste, might make Jeff Jarrett the babyface here. We get a dissolved transition to Jeff Jarrett's music. I don't know if there was some sort of promo or something in there that they've had to cut out. To no reaction, again, Jarrett's struts out. Mabel and Oscar are out next, and again the crowd are into Mabel, but Oscar's rap is terrible again.
It's getting worse.
Yes, he's just...
You liked the WrestleMania 10 version, and you think it's getting worse.
I liked the WrestleMania rap, but this rapping on the way to the ring is just awful.
There is one part in it though where he calls Jarrett Jeffrey, which I did like.
Yeah.
Jarrett avoids Mabel to begin with and struts, wasting time, as Gorilla would say.
There's also a shot of a guy in the crowd with a kid on his shoulders, and the king says, "That guy has an ugly growth on his neck."
Yes, yeah, yeah.
There's a lot I did quite like.
Mabel does some strutting, which is a bit like goose stepping.
I quite liked it. Mabel's mockery of Jeff Jarrett.
And for a minute, we had Arto Donovan back.
Arto Donovan.
Arto Donnell, he calls him, doesn't he?
Yeah, yeah.
But there was a "How big is this guy?" from, I think it was the King.
Okay.
One of them says, "How big is this guy?"
Maybe he is mocking Art Donovan.
Hopefully.
Jarrett avoids something else and does some more strutting. He does manage to leapfrog Mabel before getting big elbowed into the back. Mabel clotheslines Jarrett to the outside, and Jarrett shoves Oscar into the steps before grabbing Mabel from the outside to take him down. He does something odd from the second rope again, which I couldn't really make out what it was. Mabel wobbles, but he won't fall down from axe handles. Mabel no-sells Jarrett's punches, and Jarrett gets a sleeper, which does eventually get Mabel down to one knee, but then he squashes Jarrett in the corner.
And he does say, "I've got him," when he's on his back.
Yeah.
A couple of times.
I was listening for that noise that another podcast may talk about quite a lot. But it wasn't quite that noise.
No, not quite. It's not quite that evolved yet, but hopefully we'll see that as the podcast progresses.
Mabel hits his falling, not spinning, wheel kick, and we cut to a shot of Abe Knuckleball Schwartz wandering through the crowd.
What was that about?
Yeah, that confused
me. He was on strike, apparently, but...
That's MVP, mate.
That's MVP. What?
They later changed the name of the character to MVP.
Okay.
I guess it's something to do with there was some sort of baseball player strike in the mid-90s. So obviously WWF did some nice topical stuff to do with it. Any idea who it is under the baseball face paint?
None whatsoever. Doink.
You're not wrong.
Which one, though? Okay.
Is it Evil Doink?
No, one of the Evil Doinks.
Hang on. It would be... Oh, let me...
He's everybody, basically.
Is it the... Oh, Brooklyn Brawler?
It's the Brooklyn Brawler.
Way! Yeah. I got there. I knew the name. It was on tip of my tongue.
The tip of your tongue. You got there. This match isn't very good, but that goes without saying. Jarrett once again goes after Oscar, and Mabel follows to the outside and holds Jarrett to allow Oscar to give him a bit of a girly slap.
It was an awful slap.
Mabel then crushes Jarrett against the ring post. Mabel goes to the second rope, but misses a splash. Jarrett gets a two, and then Mabel throws him off. So I guess he's trying to show a bit of power there.
Yeah.
Jarrett goes for a sunset flip, but Mabel won't go down. Mabel sits and Jarrett moves, then covers Mabel awkwardly for the three.
It was a terrible match.
Just next.
You've made that match sound like there was a lot more action and it was a lot better than it actually was.
That was a zero-star match.
It was poor.
Yeah.
Who's not on this card?
Who's not on this card?
That should be.
Crush. Kelly.
Not Kelly Kelly and not Crush. Who had a big angle at the last pay-per-view Jeff Jarrett?
Where's the 1-2-3 kid?
The 1-2-3 kid.
Is he injured again? Or?
No, he's fine. He's playing that softball game, isn't he?
Oh, okay.
Because, Jarrett...
Well, I didn't see that.
Hit loads of pile drivers
on the kid.
So if they just fizzled that out...
I guess so.
That doesn't matter anymore.
That would have been a nice little mid-card angle. You could have given that 7 minutes.
Yeah.
And we wouldn't have had to see Mabel. I just want a campaign for more 1-2-3 kid matches, basically.
Yeah, because all his matches are really good. Quite like that. It's like a seal of quality.
We now have some time to kill while the cage goes up. So Vince introduces the super sleuths, Leslie Nielsen and Naked Gun co-star George Kennedy. They don't see The Undertaker in the entranceway behind them. Classic.
We've missed out a segment, you know. I don't know if it was on your version.
Go on then.
There was a version, because I thought we'd talk about it, and then I thought I maybe got the wrong bit, where it was the hotline.
Oh, you didn't see anything about Gorilla Monsoon on the hotline, no?
You didn't see... Gorilla Monsoon is talking on a red phone, like a classic kind of old school red phone. It's just on the microphone, and they go, we're going to cut to Gorilla Monsoon on the hotline. He's going to have whoever it is, he's going to have like somebody talking on the hotline. And then he just doesn't. And then he just goes back to you. So it's kind of really, if you're paying for the hotline, you're not even getting the, you know, IRS cutting his promo down the line. Or the 1-2-3 kid, you're getting nothing.
Bargain.
You really are. It's just Gorilla Monsoon, yeah. Yeah, he's not here. That's what it was. So no wonder they cut it out then.
Yeah. Guess who's back on WWF television? Motherfucking Bruce Hart.
Yes.
We get the Bret Owen video package, which gets longer with every pay-per-view.
Is it our favourite person that's turned up? We seem to bang on about Bruce Hart all the time.
It's one of those weird sort of lines where I don't know if he's my favourite person or my least favourite person.
He gives us plenty to talk about, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, so the Bret Owen video package, they just seem to tack another bit on as the pay-per-views go. At least there is a long-term backstory.
Yes.
Could you imagine a feud these days that dated back to, say, SummerSlam?
No.
Uninterrupted. It's unreal, isn't it? This video package now has been updated to include Bruce motherfucking Hart cutting a promo. Owen cuts a promo inside a dark cage, which I thought was quite a cool visual.
Yep.
Yep. Bret always calls SummerSlam the SummerSlam. Have you ever noticed this?
I've not.
Yeah.
He's a friend of mine with the IRS.
He calls WCW the WCW, and he always calls SummerSlam the SummerSlam.
Good for him.
Stu and Helen Hart, the parents of the entire Hart clan here, thank you very much for joining us here tonight. And I wonder if I get a word with you in terms of the steel cage match. Did you ever think it was going to come down to this with Bret against Owen inside a steel cage, Helen?
No, not in my wildest imaginings did I ever think it. I think it's a fever that's possessed Owen, and I just hope he recovers from it someday.
It must have been terribly upsetting, this whole issue, and I guess, Stu, you hope that it's going to be finished one way or the other tonight.
I hope that the best wrestler will come out with his hand raised, or the best wrestler will walk out of that ring.
In one piece, I might add.
McMahon, why don't you ask him hard questions? Why don't you get him to tell the truth? You drove Owen to this, both of you. You know you did. You brought Owen to this. You kept him down his whole life.
Hey,
you, the entire family. You all did it. The
only man, brother's back here. Wait a minute. You better watch your mouth, I'll tell you that.
The entire family has drove Owen to this.
Back live, Vince has a chat with Stu and Helen.
Thought that was interesting.
Yeah, Stu doesn't really sound with it. How old is he at this point?
Very.
I was very disappointed. He wasn't wearing his Castrol GTX bomber jacket either.
It's Jerry Lawler's dust on hand as well to hurl abuse at them.
Yeah, my note here is someone let Lawler near them. Helen thinks Owen has a fever.
And has been possessed.
Yeah, maybe Papa Shango is involved in this storyline long term. Stu says he wants the best wrestler to win. Fair enough, I suppose.
Yeah.
Lawler takes over and accuses them of both holding Owen down. We see the British Bulldog in the front row.
He looks massive.
Who definitely, definitely hasn't failed any steroid tests. How weird does it... Have you ever seen the Bulldog look like this? He looks A, inflated, B, he's got the sort of long, scraggly hair that's not dreadlocks.
Yeah, it's weird.
And he's wearing, like, reading glasses.
It's kind of like a bit like a massive Jim Morrison.
Yeah, I can see
that. He's kind of got this, like, tan, I don't know, waistcoat on with nothing underneath. You know, it's what I always wear round and about.
Yeah, you probably should.
Show off my guns.
He's very much got a voice like Wade Barrett, hasn't he? Or Wade Barrett's very much got a voice like... Are they from the same area?
Yeah, from
the
Leeds type places, Preston, yeah, that sort of vicinity of the country. Are you suggesting...
Up north.
Up north. Are you suggesting the British Bulldog could cut a sort of Bad News Barrett type promo?
Yeah. Yes. He sounds very, very much like Bad News Barrett, and he should probably have a kind of Bad News Bulldog type gimmick thing going on. So when they go to interview him, he could be like, I've got some bad news for you. Jim Neidhart's behind me, and he's probably going to interfere.
I did get distracted by his beaver in the background.
Vince is continually encouraging Jerry Lawler to talk to Bruce Hart. I'm kind of wondering why, but...
Bruce Hart's got... Do you notice? As
leather jacket and shades.
And he's kind of like... He's physically... Angling in. Trying to get in on that.
And they do mention, I don't know why this crops up at this stage, but they do mention that perhaps the cage is there to keep the hearts out of the cage rather than the people in, which is what the usual kind of objective of the cage is. And then they also mention again that Domino's delivers, so maybe Bruce and Owen, or Brett and Owen even, have ordered some pizza for halfway through the match and they're expecting somebody to knock at the cage door.
You could slide it slice by slice between the bars.
Just have a sit down and just have a meat feast.
Vince tells us that Bruce might be the most volatile heart of all. Good gimmick.
I'm in agreement with that.
I should point out this interview by saying, because the hitman will not tell everyone, he is recovering from strep throat. We did find that out. Brett, can you tell us what kind of effect that has on you? How are you feeling physically?
Has no effect. Has nothing to do with anything. I'm going in this match with one thing in mind. First of all, this World Wrestling Federation Championship belt isn't going anywhere. It's going right back over my shoulder, back in the dressing room, because I'm going to prove that I am better than Owen. I was always better than Owen. You know, Owen, I want you to understand something. I don't hate you. I don't hate your guts. I never, ever did. I never got into this thing thinking or believing that I hated your guts, because I don't. The problem with you is you. It's in your head. It's in your heart. Jealousy is a horrible thing. It's an ugly thing that's, Neidhart. Now, that might be a different story. Maybe I might just go that far and say I hate his guts, because I believe right inside my heart that it was Jim Neidhart right from the start that started all this stuff. He's the one that planted the seeds of jealousy in Owen in the first place. Owen, I don't hate you. I just kind of feel sorry for you. And in this match, brother against brother, Cain and Abel, whatever you want to call it, it breaks my heart to think that it's come this far, that two brothers are going to be in the most, this is barbaric. This has nothing to do with what we grew up with, believing in wrestling, exchanging holds and all. This has gone way beyond that. This is out of the dungeon now. This is a dogfight. This is like caged animals, and it's something that I'm not very proud of. But the fact is, it has to stop. You know, people don't understand when I got my mother come up to me with tears in her eyes and beg me to see this thing end. My father wants to see it end. Everybody wants to see it end. And I've tried to end it. I've tried to find some place to stop it. And there's no place you can end it. But now I see this is it. It's going to be an ugly fight. It's going to be a dog fight. And there's going to be one winner and one loser. And I'm not going to lose this thing, Owen. I'm going in there with every single thing I got. And I'm going to beat you, brother. And I just hope, after it's all said and done, that you can live with it.
Todd is backstage with Brett. Apparently, Brett has had strep throat. Anyone have any idea what that is?
It's a sore throat.
Yeah, I think so.
What does strep mean?
Streptococcus, I think.
Yeah, okay. It's like strepsils. That's where that comes from. It
okay.
relieves
we'll,
the pain.
We'll do the research for the next episode.
Brett says he blames the anvil for Owen's behaviour. And it's a pretty good promo from Brett.
Yeah, quite liked it.
He sells reluctance to accept the match and says that this whole thing is out of control and needs to end, basically. Yeah, cage match is a good place to end a feud, really. I like it. Our next match is Brett versus Owen in a cage match for the WWF title. Fink runs down the rules of the match, exit the cage by the door or over the top, so no pins or submissions.
Was there a reason for this?
Just the story they wanted to tell, I guess.
Okay, yeah.
Is this a particularly short cage, or is it the same height as all the blue cages?
Well, it's 15 foot. They keep banging on about it.
I don't know. It just looked a bit shorter to me.
Owen enters. He enters the cage by climbing over the top and jumps down and sort of falls over.
I thought he covered for it quite well.
Yeah. He does make it into sort of a little joke. Yeah, a little joke. Brett is out next to a big ovation. Bruce hugs Brett to get himself a bit of camera time. Owen attacks Brett to open hop, mounting him in the corner with fists and then uppercuts and boots.
They do say at the start of this match, I think it's Jerry the King says, you won't see much in the way of scientific skills in this match, so unfortunately we won't get any Bunsen burners or distillation going on. Bit gutted about that.
So, yeah, we won't see much of scientific skills from these two world-renowned scientific-skilled wrestlers.
But that's the level this feud has got to. Yeah, it's not about science anymore.
It's a shame.
It's about spats in cages.
Yeah, it's about jumping out of a cage.
It's about Bruce Hart.
It's about Bruce Hart, yeah. Brett gets an atomic drop and clothesline to take Owen down. Owen stamps on Brett's fingers, which I like as a good strategy to prevent climbing.
Oh, that's genius.
Yeah. Brett hits a DDT on Owen early on. Brett attempts to exit over the top, but Owen pulls him back down. Owen gets his first enziguri and makes his first escape attempt.
He must have a foot like a traction engine as well.
He gets one leg over, but Brett grabs the other and
he gets his leg over.
Him back in. Yes, he gets his leg over with his brother.
Oh, you made that into something bad.
No, you started it and I finished it.
You started it? Are you a child?
Anyway, Brett back suplexes Owen back into the ring.
They're really good at, and I don't want to keep mentioning it every time they do it because they do it a lot. They're really, really good at almost escaping.
Yeah.
But not quite. It always looks like they're, it's so spot on in terms of its timing. Yeah, he's going to get out. He's definitely going to get out. But they always manage to pull him just back in.
What's this word that I have written in my notes in a box?
Justin Bieber.
No, not Justin Bieber. That's to the side of it.
Oh, believable.
Believable.
Does he have Justin Bieber written down?
Yeah.
Yeah. Don't give away my song for the end of the show, guys.
Okay. Yes, I like in this match, and this is a symptom of later ladder matches as well, the slow climbing.
Just my head.
You're ridiculously slow at climbing, but you can still do everything else at a normal pace. This one, even 20 minutes in, when they're making their escapes, they're going for it to get out.
It's just the idea of the psychology of it, you know, the whole point of the match is to get out of the cage.
I suppose that's the logic for taking away the pin and submission rules, though, because you would have kind of two different strategies there. Then, wouldn't you? In this, they're not trying to win a match for a pinfall or a submission, so they're not working holds or countering holds or any of that.
Yeah,
they are doing something to try and get their opponent down and then trying to leg it out.
Yes.
I guess if you add the pin and submission back in, you've then got varying strategies in trying to accomplish what you're trying to achieve, if that makes any sense.
It's more of a quick hit and run.
Yeah, rather than let's wrestle a really scientific or a really intense brawl or something to get a pinfall to end this feud. No, I'm going to try and get you down and then I'm going to try and leg it over the top.
I think
or through the door.
A nice, I don't know if it was just the intention or a side product of that, is it makes it very, very different from the WrestleMania 10 match.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
So a completely different style.
Yeah.
It's relatively early on. I think it was relatively early on in this. There's one of the bits where Brett tries to get out the door. He's been doing this back and forth for a little bit, but there's one where Brett tries to get out and Owen leaps from basically the opposite corner in a very Superman style to grab him. I love that.
That was actually kind of about halfway through the match. It wasn't so early, but yeah, it was a real good dive and it was out of nowhere because Owen looks half dead on the cameras in the other corner.
And then he just kind of gets up and
bam, he's there.
Yeah, I think to kind of go through this match as we do sort of segment by segment would lead to a lot of sort of repetition really. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, just pick out, like you have Adam there with your favourite moment there, some of the different escape attempts that you enjoyed.
And there's a few where they're going up and they're up and they're over.
Yeah.
And then it's the jump up and grab them by the hair and yank their head back over. I quite like those ones.
I like that as a whole kind of thing because they got to that stage quite early on where you think somebody's going to win this soon because the volume of escape attempts that they have is massive. And you think somebody's going to win this pretty quick.
I know this sounds really, really odd, but everything in this match is about trying to win.
Yes.
Like there's nothing done for show or there's nothing done to look cool or to be part of a sequence. It's trying to win. Like you say, it's getting your opponent down. It's trying to finish the match and trying to get out.
Yeah, and it works.
Everything is about escape attempts. Absolutely everything is about escape attempts.
One of my favourite bits was there was a brilliant drop kick from Owen from the top rope.
Yeah,
and then after that, he runs from one side of the ring and launches himself at the cage and just kind of catches on and starts climbing. That was cool.
Yeah,
the crowd react for every escape attempt as well.
Yeah,
I think the danger might have been you do 50 escape attempts, which I'd wager it's probably somewhere near 50.
Yeah, I think so.
And by the end, the crowd aren't buying it anymore. No, they're into every single one here.
Well, as we point out, it's been a very long, carefully orchestrated storyline, so there's reason to be involved in it. If this was just out the blue type of match, I think people would start to tire a little bit of it.
Yeah, and really, both of them look like they could win at any time.
Yeah.
Which just keep them on the edge of your seat.
There is no clear winner, and that's another thing that they've done a nice job at in the build-up to this, in the matches that they've had. There's no dominant brother, is there?
Well, no, there is. You take the arc of the storyline.
Or does Owen win?
Owen beat Brett clean at WrestleMania. Owen has then gone and done the King of the Ring, which Brett did the previous year. That says to me, Owen's the dominant one on the arc of things. You disagree.
I guess I'm just kind of thinking of it as that...
He's saying his graph's got a steeper gradient.
Yes.
Brett's more on top of the pile in terms of the whole company.
Yeah, true.
There was a beautiful pile driver by Owen.
Yes, there are some nice moves and stuff. Yeah,
he's got a lovely way of setting up the pile driver, actually, hasn't he? Where he makes sure that they're in the right position. He's got a kind of like a half squat motion. Make sure they're stable and then does it.
Yeah.
I think it's probably, I know I know what obviously happens later further on into the future, but it seems like a very safe way of doing a pile driver because you make sure that everything's in the right position before you land it. Mm.
They do mention on commentary that Davey Boy Smith sounds like a trained seal because it's clapping so hard.
Is that Jerry Lawler by any chance?
I think it may be Jerry Lawler. And then you get like the big spot of the match. Soon after that, you get the massive suplex off the top, which was just
unbelievable.
The suplex was great, yeah.
I mean, they say it's a 15-foot high cage, and I guess they mean that must be from the floor, not from the canvas.
Yeah.
Because it's probably something more like about 10, 11 foot odd, I'd guess. But that is still a huge bump. They come down from a good height on
absolutely.
That.
That requires quite a good level of trust, I imagine, as well, to do that with someone.
That must have been quite scary to do, I thought.
There are a couple of bits they do with the cage itself as well. There's a bit where Owen has Brett in a waist lock from behind, and Brett sort of deliberately runs into the cage and then drops down so Owen goes into it. That I really, really like. Yeah. There's a bit where Brett monkey flips Owen into the cage as well, which is pretty cool.
They occasionally were cutting back to the kind of the Hart family, and there was one time where they were just kind of panning around. I was a bit gutted because I couldn't see Bruce's face, but I imagine he probably had a look where he's thinking, oh my God, they're stealing my thunder.
It should be me. It should be me.
And you get a sharpshooter from Owen as well.
Did you hear what he shouts while he's got the sharpshooter?
I'm going to break his legs.
I'm going to break his legs. Good stuff.
Love it. I'm going to kick the leg out of his leg.
Well, he does that earlier in the match as well.
Yes, he does.
It was a cool transition. Brett goes into his sharpshooter from Owen's, where he sort of kicks Owen back down so they're both laying on the canvas, and then Brett sits up. So it's not a reversal as such, but it's a transition from one into the other. And Owen visually taps as well. So in a way, that's a decisive victory for Brett over Owen as well. He's giving up.
And this is literally the point where I've got in my notes here, how is it going to end? Because I'm thinking, with all the kind of escapes that they've tried and done, how is this going to end? Because it wouldn't make sense if they just did, you know, something similar to that they've done before in terms of the escapes of the cage and just ended it that way. They'd have to do something different. And then we get the end, which is different and was cool.
Well, both men climb to the outside of the cage, and it's quite a cool visual having two people sort of hanging on the outside of a cage. Owen, however, traps his legs between the blue bars as they descend to the floor, and Brett basically just jumps down for the win. It's a cool
visual. I
seem to have a recollection of an Edge and Christian cage match from 2000-2001-ish, where they're in the blue cage, and there's something like, I don't know which way around it is, but one of them pulls the other one's legs through and ties their boots together with their laces to stop them escape. I think the person whose feet it was pulled through was on the outside, so had nearly won, and they kind of yanked their legs through, tied their boots together, and then just kind of sauntered out, which
Well, they've done it as a finisher to ladder matches as well, haven't they, where people have got their legs trapped in the ladders and they're sort of hanging upside down. Immediately as the match finishes, the Anvil attacks Davey Boy and clotheslines both Davey and Diana over the barricade.
Yeah. Diana Boy Smith.
Diana Boy Smith.
Yeah, I like that
surname.
I think so.
I like the Anvil. He's got no scruples. He'll just club a woman.
The Anvil then goes for Brett, and Owen joins in as the family attend to the Bulldog. Owen and the Anvil take Brett back into the cage, and the Anvil, after much struggle, padlocks it shut.
It takes him ages, doesn't it?
He was really struggling with that, and I thought it was a bit embarrassing because they kind of could have done with like the camera cutting away, because all the other hearts were there trying to get in, thinking, just help him lock the case to start off with, and then you can try and get into it.
It's like that. Who's in that cage match? The one where Mark Henry's... Is it Batista and The Undertaker, where Mark Henry's trying to rip the cage door off, and it literally takes him about half an hour? I'll try and find the clip of it, but it's hilarious. It's going on for ages and ages. The Bulldog is back up and he tries to climb in, but Owen stops him. The Hart brothers, including Bruce, try to climb in, but Owen and Anvil continually cut them off. Come on, Bruce, get in there.
Well, he climbs up and then he takes the most lame bump from the outside. I thought, we're going to see something special here from Bruce. And we didn't. I was so disappointed.
Teddy Hart would have done like a super double moonflip back kick senton splash to the floor or something.
What is Teddy Hart doing these days? Is he actually wrestling anywhere?
He's launching a wrestling federation with his cats.
What?
That almost serious? Sounds like a joke.
I'm not joking.
I think I've heard something about this before.
I showed you the video, didn't I? Yeah, yeah.
Tell me more.
He wanted to train cats and dogs to wrestle.
Clearly of sound mind.
This guy needs help.
Although, if he can do it,
We'll all look silly, won't we?
We're all on the edge of our seats.
Well, if I see a cat pile driver another cat...
Well, in 20 years, mate, when we're doing like a podcast based on Teddy Hart's Cat and Dog Wrestling Federation, we'll all have a bit of humble pie to eat in episode 1.
Yeah, fair enough.
Bulldog eventually manages to get in, and Owen and the Anvil basically hightail it. They exit to Big Booze as the rest of the Hearts make their way in.
I thought that's a really cool image. Just the others eventually get in, which they should do because they've got the numbers. I just like the way that they're just sneaky, get out of the cage and run away. That's brilliant.
Yeah. This was a great match.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. So, I really like the ending of it as well. I think Neidhart and Owen, even though there's more people trying to climb in, did a real good job of just giving enough of a kick in to Brett and then punching everyone else off.
Yeah, it was good.
It was, and I find Jim the Anvil Neidhart, I find a very scary looking man.
Yeah, no, it's very cool, I thought.
I thought it's different to every other cage match. That sounds like a massive sort of
blanket statement.
90% of other cage matches are about violence and about brutality and stuff, and this very much wasn't. And consider they're performing in a time where they aren't going to have the sort of late 80s NWA, you know, scraping your head against the cage type match, or they're not going to have that type of match. They're not going to be allowed to do a lot of the stuff you would do in that. So yeah, it's very different. Like I say, everything's about the escape attempts. Nothing's about trying to do cool shit off cages or onto cages or anything like that.
It was very fresh.
Very different.
Yeah.
I just really liked it.
Yeah, very
good match.
A very enjoyable match. How long was it, though?
Half an hour, 32 minutes.
Yeah.
However, you know, enough with that. Let's move on to our real main event.
Backstage, Todd chases Owen and the Anvil. Owen celebrates for some reason and cuts a bit of a shouty promo.
I'm liking his promos. And he's learned, hasn't he? You know, his promos are now pretty decent.
He does say, "Let's go celebrate my victory."
I like that.
I'm not sure he's understood. Completely.
No, I think it's the whole kind of I'm in denial kind of thing. And
I ended up beating up my brother.
Woo!
I might have lost the match, but I won out in the end. It's that kind of thing.
The King Lawler does also say, "I don't know if Stu Hart's going to make it through the night."
It's nice of him.
Although I've just realised that I spelt night with a K. So I don't know if it was one of King's hearts.
One of his knights. Well, we now need to kill time while they take down the cage. Just take ages. Fair enough, though. So we see the backstory on the upcoming main event. Various people claim to have seen The Undertaker, including small children.
You know, the other day I was working, and guess who walked in? The Undertaker. I couldn't believe it. This guy was huge.
Bryn, did you see The Undertaker?
I saw him outside. Slid down a slide.
Man, when the smoke started to clear, there was this big figure standing there. And when it cleared up, I looked. It was The Undertaker.
Did you see the man who was just in here? He was enormous.
Oh, I saw him. That was The Undertaker.
No, not The Undertaker.
This was brilliant. He was on a slide.
Well, good way of demystifying The Undertaker. He plays on children's slides.
He pops into the butcher's. he's a children's play area.
Then he goes to work at Domino's.
No, before that he goes to a fireman's. Perhaps wants to slide down a fireman's pole.
Well, he needs to sort of resolve those childhood issues with Kane, doesn't he?
Okay, yeah.
That could be it. Foreshadowing there.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, it was that carefully thought out.
So let's tackle this then. On the 5th of June episode of Wrestling Challenge, Ted DiBiase appeared as a guest on Shawn Michaels' interview segment, The Heartbreak Hotel, where he claimed that The Undertaker had aligned himself with the $1 million corporation. He then produced The Undertaker, except it wasn't Mark Calloway. It was Brian Lee.
Should I know this?
He's had a few stints in ECW, or would go on to have a few stints rather in ECW, and he would be a member of the DOA later on, who we'll see towards
the Disciples of the Apocalypse.
Yeah. At this point, he's a former USWA and Smoky Mountain wrestling talent who is a personal friend of Mark Calloway. This Undertaker, however, was guided not by the urn, but by money. So in many ways, he's kind of a mid-90s Brock Lesnar.
Fair enough.
As part of getting a gig as the fake Undertaker, Lee was asked not to leave the house so he wouldn't tan and therefore be pale. You know, like a dead person. Or Seamus.
Fair play. Yeah.
Also, his Taker tattoos are fake, so he's not gone to that extent for the gimmick.
I did wonder about the tattoos. They looked similar.
Needless to say, Paul Bearer was not pleased with this development, claiming that DiBiase's Undertaker wasn't the real Undertaker, and that at SummerSlam, he would produce the real Undertaker to take out DiBiase's fake Undertaker. Truly, this is wrestling Shakespeare. There is one piece of continuity that I do like about this that I'm sure is incidental. It was Ted DiBiase that introduced the original Undertaker to the WWF at the 1990 Survivor Series, though I'm sure that's a happy coincidence rather than deliberate long-term storytelling.
Was there a reason for the original introduction of the Undertaker?
He was just a mystery partner on DiBiase's team.
Okay.
That was it.
Good mystery partner to have.
Yeah, it worked out all right.
Did he walk into a feud with Hogan when he first came in?
Or no, was that, was about a year later? In. DiBiase enters first for the main event. And for the purposes of ease of describing this match, rather than saying Undertaker does this to the Undertaker, we're going to refer to the fake Undertaker as Bob.
Bob?
Bob?
Bob.
Bob?
Okay.
So that's what I've done for my notes. Why it doesn't get confusing.
See, I'd have perhaps gone with grey and purple Undertaker.
It's too many syllables.
Yeah.
Bob's nice and simple.
Bob looks shorter than the Undertaker on first impressions.
He's also got a different face.
Bob doesn't sound as intimidating.
That's part of the problem, really. Vince declares this is a one-of-a-kind matchup. And yeah, this is where I've got in my notes that DiBiase is supposed to be the million-dollar man, but he's wearing tracky bottoms.
Yeah.
Yeah, doesn't look great. Next out is the real Undertaker. Oh, no, wait. It's Paul Bearer.
Paul Bearer.
He beckons some druids holding the
double wide, double deep
casket. And someone's done some graffiti on it.
It's been tagged.
But you see, people think that inside this casket is going to be the Undertaker. The commentators are convinced of this. However, from watching that clip of the pre-show of WrestleMania, the kind of their version of Access from WrestleMania 10.
We've already seen the inside
of this casket.
Yeah, true.
So they've obviously forgotten this.
Yeah.
Or they weren't at the Access from...
Well, they placed the casket right next to the ring, which I thought was going to be him then coming out of it. But Bearer brings out a double deep, double wide urn.
Urn, yes.
Yeah. I remember thinking, why is this urn so giant? And then we find out.
He gives it to Earl Hebner for a second. When he realises someone might buy it in a car park, he takes it back.
Got that in just in time.
Yep. A light comes out of the urn and Bearer spins around. We get thunder and lightning.
I love Bearer's face here. It was amazing. Yeah.
Well, he is hands down the best thing about this match.
Well, this is where you get to the Shawn Michaels of levels of over-the-topness that just makes things work again, isn't it?
Taker's music hits for the third time, and this time the real Undertaker emerges in the entranceway. Helpfully, he's decided to wear purple gloves so he doesn't get confused with Bob.
Mm. Is this the first time his purple gloves turn up?
I believe so, but maybe wrong.
I like it. I like the purple glove.
The crowd do recognise this as the actual Undertaker, though. Yeah,
he's got the face that
they recognise. There'd have to be idiots not to.
Probably the best thing about this match is the derobing routine at the start where they do mirror each other
quite well.
Yeah. They then face off, but Bob is way shorter.
I think they could have been more creative with their camera angles here to make the discrepancy look smaller. I mean, Adam, you're the technical guy, but...
Well, I would have just given Bob bigger shoes.
See, that's the level of ingenuity that you're famed for.
So have them in like 4-inch platforms.
That would have explained a lot of the wrestling that was later to come.
Yeah. It'd be really hard to wrestle him, but there's not really any wrestling in this match. So.
No. Well, Taker knocks Bob to the outside and Bob goes for Bearer. Taker grabs Bob by the hair to bring him back into the ring, which he does via a very sloppy-looking suplex that he almost sort of falls over in.
Now, at this point, because I didn't know any of this, Brian Lee, is it?
Yeah.
About him actually being a wrestler. So I have got, is that guy a wrestler? And in brackets, I am Art Donovan.
Yes, he is one of the wrestlers, Paul.
Yeah, but that's kind of the level that he's got to. Like, okay. It's hard to tell.
Well, the crowd are completely silent. Yeah. Like,
no one cares about this match.
I would wager that the dark match would have had more crowd participation than
this. That almost like they're in front of a Japanese crowd where...
Yes, it is.
But I don't get the feeling it's sort of respectful silence.
Well, it's just the fact that this is clearly not going to be a contest. It's not even like a jobber match, is it?
Boredom and confusion, and it's your main event.
They brawl a bit on the outside, and Bob stunners Taker over the top rope. Both men are moving very, very, very slowly, like slower than IRS.
I think one of the other things that makes it very difficult to buy into this match is that Bob can't even punch.
No, his punches aren't anywhere near as good.
I could have done a better job.
He's got the action
wrestle,
but not the execution, I don't think.
He just looks rubbish.
Bob goes for old school, but Taker pulls him off the ropes. Bob then sits up to no reaction. He can't even get one for the zombie spot. No. Taker then does old school, which does get a mild reaction, and then Bob sloppily drops Taker onto the ropes in sort of stun gun type maneuver. Vince's line is, he refers to the virtual silence of the stunned crowd. Yeah, that's it, Vince.
Yeah.
Bored crowd.
Yeah. They trade fists, and I've really stopped caring by this point, I'll be perfectly honest.
I'll be honest, the one move that I thought he did a reasonably decent job of by Bob was a chokeslam.
Yeah.
Which wasn't amazing, but it wasn't bad. And then he goes for a tombstone.
Well, he kneels down to pin Taker, and then Taker sits up, and then Bob hits his own tombstone to no reaction. Taker does his sit-up, which the audience does like. Another tombstone attempt, but Taker reverses it, and then hits a jumping tombstone.
That was a good jumping tombstone.
Yeah, I really like that one. Yeah.
Taker then grabs Bob and hits a regular tombstone. Then another. Three count. Thank fuck it's over. The crowd go mild for the end.
Yeah, I put mild pop for pin.
And the Million Dollar Man just runs away.
Yeah, Taker goes towards DiBiase, but he's out there. He runs past the Druids. Bob gets put in the casket, never to be seen again. Five stars, bearer shines his own at the Undertaker. Terrible.
But then, but we do get the bit at the end where we get Leslie Nielsen is back and he finds the casket.
And there's nothing in it.
Nothing inside.
But maybe he will come back one day.
No, well, maybe. But the case is closed.
Yeah, the case is closed.
And they know that because there's literally a closed case there. Well done.
So what did we think to this match, gentlemen?
Big pile of pants.
Can I be really honest with you?
You really liked it, didn't you?
No, I'm gonna lay this down, that I really like the idea for this kind of match. I think that if you had somebody that could wrestle, if you had a Kane playing the fake Undertaker, playing Bob, then this could have really worked. I quite liked all that build-up, even like the silliness of I've seen the Undertaker. I really kind of liked that kind of stuff and thought that this could have been entertaining. But the problem is, Bob can't wrestle, and it was never going to work.
That is a pretty big problem.
So I went in expecting to actually enjoy this match, even though I'd read some bad things about it, but I didn't.
It's such a unique atmosphere. That's almost the most interesting thing about it is...
Yeah?
Is there something below apathy? Like...
Pathy.
Pathy.
They've got a bit of...
I don't want to be infamous. I want to be... Fumous.
Bit of pathy on the go.
Yeah.
Sounds like a bit of a Scott Steiner thing, doesn't it? It's a bit like simpy.
Well, they definitely ain't got no simpy for this match.
I ain't got no simpy for this match.
I mean, even Chopper's that Giant Gonzalez match was better than this.
Yeah.
Because you had the cool visual of Taker climbing up him and stuff. There was stuff going on. Yes, you had the jumping tombstone in this, but that was about it. And yeah, the crowd thing, I can't get over the crowd thing. It's just so weird. Mm. It's not like they're going off to do other stuff. They are just sat there in silence.
And I thought it was weird because I would have bought in more than they did. I mean, it wasn't good. Like, don't get me wrong, it wasn't a good match, but I still can't believe how little they bought in, particularly for the actual Undertaker's offense.
Mm. Yeah, it's very, very odd. How do we feel about this being positioned as the main event?
It's quite offensive, really.
Well, if I'm honest, though, I don't know where you'd have put it.
The bin.
Well, yeah.
The bad ideas draw.
I reckon with what they perceive it's going to be like and with a bit of effort that they've put into it, I think they would still put it on the card. You should have switched the cage match in this round.
I would have almost not even done it as a match, but more done it as an angle.
Yeah.
Like maybe like a 10-15 minute segment with DiBiase, Bearer, probably not Leslie Nielsen. And then just have it as an angle rather than a match. I don't know the answer is.
Have Real Undertaker just squash him.
Yeah, yeah, quickly. Rather than have this really bad 10-minute match.
Because, yeah, the 10 minutes of the match were absolutely pointless. All it was about, really, was the tombstone, win. So you didn't need a 10-minute boar fest to go in there. And, yeah, maybe if you'd have had lots of DiBiase and Paul Bearer mouthing off at each other, that could have been much more interesting.
And, again, I'm going to sound like a broken fucking record, but at WrestleMania 10, we crowned Bret Hart as the face of our new generation, and he's the world champion. And for the second pay-per-view on a row, the world title isn't being defended in the main event, and he's playing second fiddle to silly fucking bullshit.
Yeah.
And this is why Bret gets excluded from these debates sometimes as the greatest of all time, but he doesn't get that commitment that... I know I've gone on about this so much now, but he doesn't get the commitment that a Hogan or a Cena or an Austin got.
You are quite riled by this.
I am, yeah.
I can see it in your face.
Thank you.
It was a compliment.
So this was pretty fucking silly, but not as silly as some of the things that could have come from it. One of the proposed endings for this match was for the two Undertakers to lock up or engage in some sort of test of strength and have a pyro lightning bolt type thing strike them both. The lights would then go out, obviously. Bob would hide under the ring. And when the lights come back in, only the real Undertaker would be left, or the implication would be that they'd merged into one.
See, I'd have kind of liked that more. I don't know if that's any sillier than what actually happened.
It's one way to win a match, I suppose, osmosis. What was also supposed to come of this was a series of matches between the two Undertakers leading to a babyface tag team of the two together.
Glad they didn't do that.
Thankfully, this angle fell so flat that it was scrapped immediately following this show and Lee was canned as the fake Undertaker.
So was it the Undertaker's, the Undertaker's idea to bring in Bob?
Yes.
Was it his idea for the angle?
I don't know if the angle's his idea, but I think when they're saying, right, we're going to have someone play a fake you, he gets his mate a job.
Yeah, you see, for me, I don't not like the idea for the angle. I just think the execution was poor.
Well, they put themselves in a bit of a funny position with the way that they got rid of The Undertaker. In that manner, there's got to be something unique and special to bring him back.
I was expecting,
but is there a good way of doing it?
I was expecting Marty Jannetty just to descend from the
ceilings. Yeah. Descend from main event status.
Well, no, he'd be in the main event, wouldn't he?
Yeah, true.
That could have worked.
Macho Man is in the aisle and he's going home, basically.
What is Macho Man's job at the minute?
He's the host, mate.
He's the host. He told us at the start that this would be the best night ever, and it was.
Yeah. In a quick ending promo as well, Paul Bearer told us so.
I love Paul Bearer. He did his best to try and save that crash of a main event.
But
there's,
alas,
there's only so much you can do.
So that wraps us up for SummerSlam 1994. Time to do the rounds, boys. Adam, match of the night.
The women's match was a resounding favourite. Something very different, very good. Excellent level of skill. Yeah, really, really good.
Excellent. Your MVP?
Bull Nakano.
Okay.
I'm sticking with the sort of like this women's match because it was amazing. And I would have been perhaps tempted to give it maybe to Owen, but the use of that scorpion
crosslock,
yeah, it was just so awesome. I had to give it to you. Yeah, definitely did it for me.
Okay, Paul, match of the night.
Well, it's a hard one because you have got an absolutely amazing match in. The cage match was brilliant, really was. The problem that I have with this is I was expecting it. I've had the WrestleMania 10 match between two brothers, and that was awesome. And I was expecting this to be awesome, and it was. But what I wasn't expecting was to have that women's match and just to be blown away by that, and for that reason and no other really, that I'm going to put that ahead of the cage match because it just blew me away and I didn't think it was going to. And I'm going to agree with Adam that Bull Nakano is my new favourite wrestler.
So she's your MVP as well?
She's my MVP, no doubt about it. Yeah.
Fair enough.
And yourself?
Match of the night, I'm going to go against you two and just go with the cage match.
That's fair enough.
I feel it deserves at least one of us to say it's the match of the night.
I can't go against you. It was brilliant. It's just for the reasons I stated.
I think the reason I like it is, like I said earlier, it's so different to any other cage match. It's not about violence or brutality. It's about winning. It's about escaping. If I could change one thing about it, I would
get rid of more
Bruce Hart. I would get rid of, make it a triple threat. I would get rid of the door thing. No. Make him special referee and then just have him act like just the world's most self-centered cunt throughout the entire thing. Have him go to Shawn Michaels for lessons and sort of self-promotion.
Could borrow his outfit.
No, I'd get rid of the door thing. I don't know what that is. I've always hated that in cage matches. Keep that door fucking locked. Especially when they're saying as part of the angle they want to keep the Harts out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Honourable mentions absolutely go to that women's match. It's fucking fantastic. I think everyone should check that out.
Yeah.
It's definitely in the top couple of matches, full stop, we've watched on the podcast so far.
Yeah.
It's unlike any women's match you'll see today. I mean, don't get me wrong, that Paige Emma match at NXT Arrival is brilliant, really, really love it. But it's a level above that as well.
Yeah.
And I think if you really do like that sort of thing, Paul, I'll link you to some sort of AJW stuff from the 90s, which is a lot more along those lines. They are dragging that sort of type of wrestling forward, and it's very much unlike what we see in the WWF. I'll give an honourable mention to the IC title match as well. I thought that was very, very good.
Yeah, that was good.
I mean, yes, there are some duds on this card, but I think as a whole, those three matches just really drag the overall quality of it up.
Yeah.
MVP, I think I'm going to have to go with Bob. He did such a great and convincing job. Brett or Owen, I don't want to split it on this one. I'm going to pussy out and say they were both brilliant in the cage match.
Oh, I don't know. Can he do that?
Is that allowed?
I'm not keen on it. I think it's
am I being vetoed?
Decide.
I think you got to pick one. I mean, they're both equally good performances, but there must be one reason that you prefer one more to the other.
I'll go with Bull Nakano then.
Okay.
Because she deserves a special mention too, and her performance was standout. Yeah. So, yes, she can get the MVP from all of us. Adam, mullet of the night.
Well, it's a clean sweep for Bull Nakano. She's getting it because this is unlike any other mullet that we've seen. I'm not entirely sure that it is technically classified as a mullet, but she's kind of made it into some sort of super Megatron mullet. So yeah, she gets that.
Just to mention too, just out of left field a bit here, that yesterday I took a trip to a farm and I saw some ducks and assorted poultry with some interesting hairdos, I think it's the way to say it. I might post those on the internet and just see what you make of those.
I'll definitely give you an opinion.
If you prefer any of those to Bull Nakano's hair.
It's unlikely.
So would we recommend this show for people to watch?
Yeah, but just turn it off about 20 minutes before the end.
Yes, definitely.
I think it's, like I say, those three matches really dragged the quality of the card up. And I can even stand the Tatanka Luger stuff.
Yeah.
The opening match is all right.
The opener was pretty good, yeah.
I think that WrestleMania aside, this has been the best card.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was very good.
I could agree with that.
It was up and down, but
the ups were up enough.
Yes, definitely.
So we've got a quick couple of things I want to plug before we go today. Firstly, Chris Pilkington's Gratitude Era mashup album. Have you had a listen to this yet, either of you?
I had a bit of a listen to bits and bobs of it, yeah.
If you happen to be a fan of the Beastie Boys and Attitude Era theme tunes, which I definitely am, then this is definitely for you. Chris has done some music bits for us. He did the Art Donovan one on The King of the Ring, and he did the opening of the last show for us. And this honestly is genius. Really, really awesome.
Very, very amusing.
Good guy.
So search soundcloud.com for Chris Pilkington and check it out. You'll see him on our page as well. And secondly, the guys over at historyofwrestling.info have just produced their fifth edition of the complete WWF video guide, covering late 1999 up until 2002. I've just finished grabbing all the Raw Files books, which have been really useful little guides when doing research for what we're doing. So if you go to lulu.com, which is their independent book publishing company, and search for complete WWF video guides and check out their books. They get the highest recommendation from me.
And
Lee,
me.
You're a fan as well.
I am.
I've skimmed them. They look quite nice.
Excellent. That's it for this episode. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/newgenerationprojectpodcast. You can find us on Twitter at newgenpodcast.
Hang on, no, that's not how we do this.
I was not going to give you the opportunity to say at WrestleMaster.
No, I wasn't going to say at WrestleMaster.
Do you want to do it properly then?
Go on, yeah.
You can find us on Twitter at
the slightly simpler
New Gen Podcast. As said, we're on SoundCloud at soundcloud.com/newgenpodcast, and you can also search for us on Stitcher Radio as well. We are on the not so brand new piledriverwrestling.net, but still very good. New episodes from the Attitude Era and OSW have been posted recently as well on there. Yeah. As ever, you can rate, review and subscribe in iTunes. Give us a nice review. We'd like it. Episode 10 will be another deviation from our main timeline.
We keep deviating a lot. Are we deviants?
We are deviants. We will be looking at some of the best TV matches of 1994, including one that will set up one of our main events for Survivor Series 1994. Oh. Otherwise, you might be a bit like, what the fuck? Where did this come from?
Yeah, so a bit of context would be nice.
Yeah. And I don't mean to say that what we're going to see is going to be typical of the week-by-week TV product in 1994, but there are definitely some really good matches that I want us to check out and just have a chance to watch. And some other good news...
It's the Cricket World Cup 2020 final today.
No, Bull Nakano's going to be on it as well.
Woo!
So you get one more chance to see her before she's gone.
But I thought we'd mention cricket again one more time.
Yeah, just get another reference in there. That's our gimmick now. My name's Stuart Brooks. I shall say goodbye.
I'm Adam Wykes. Goodbye.
I'm at WrestleMaths. Goodbye.
Fuck off. It's time for you to sing, Paul.
I feel it in my fingers, I feel it in my toes,
I'm swaying.
Love is all around me, and so the feeling grows. It's written in the wind, it's everywhere. So if you really love me, come on and let it show. Whoa. You know I love you, I always will. My mind's made up by the way I feel. There's no beginning, there we go. Face before me as I lay on my bed. I get to thinking of all the things you said.
Oh, yes, I did.
You give me a promise to me, and I give mine to you.
That's your bigger figure.
I need someone beside me
in everything I do. Oh, yes, I do. Yes, I do. Me next. You know I love you. I always will. My mind's made up. Singing the words, yeah. So if you're in.